I'm going to call to order a regular meeting for the Grover Beach City Council. For more, please be seated. Roll call.
Here.
Present.
Here.
Here.
Here. Thank you, Donna. City Attorney, can you cover our closed session announcements this evening?
Certainly, Honorable Mayor, Council members. At the last meeting on November 5th, Council met in closed session on two items. First one being existing litigation, Lopez versus City of Grover Beach. The second one being negotiations regarding a private property with Digital West and the city being the two parties. Council convened into open session. There were no reportable actions taken.
Very good. Thank you. Okay, we're going to move on to, agenda review. This is where the council review the order of business as written by staff and making a decision if we want to change the order of the agenda. Do any members of the council wish to change the order of the agenda?
Okay. Honorable Mayor, staff
yes.
Request that the closed session item, Lopez versus City of Grover Beach, be pulled and tabled. We're expecting a decision on the hearing. Have not received it yet from the court, so there is no reason to meet.
Okay. Very good. Thank you, City Attorney. Okay, someone prepared to make a motion on the agenda.
I will make a motion that we accept the agenda as presented.
I'll second it.
Very good. There's a motion and a second. If there's no additional discussion, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? None. Motion carries. So we've got a lengthy agenda tonight, and we've got some really good items on here that will get us off to a very positive start. So we always are excited about those items on the agenda. So we're going to move into our ceremonial calendar. This is item number one on the agenda. There are extra copies, I believe, on the table to our right. And this is a mayor's accommodation honoring longtime Grover Beach residents and business owners Gene and Gracia Bello. And I've got a long staff report here, and if I read all the accomplishments, we'd be here half the night. But let me say a few things. From the beginning, the Bellows have been active in local and civic affairs. They were part of the original business group that started the Grover City Civic Association in 1956, and they were also active members of the Chamber of Commerce. Gene and Gracia remain active with the Chamber to this day. Local education was also important to the Bellows, and Gene served a four-year term on the school board in the early 1960s, and I believe Gracia has recently been serving with Cuesta College, or I'm sorry, with the Botanical Gardens, correct. 1956, they bought the Grover City Pharmacy and had worked on that, and I think the coolest thing is to be able to say they've got actually business license number one. I always tell that story. I love telling that story. So the Bellows were also active in real estate ventures. It was mainly through the efforts of the Bellows who purchased and consolidated a number of small commercial properties along Grand Avenue that the construction of a prominent financial institution was possible. The property subsequently became Midstate Bank and is now the location of Rabo Bank. Gracia also demonstrated her talent for marketing, and when the couple opened a second location, Gracia stocked the shelves with a variety of merchandise and was actually a forerunner for the modern-day corporate pharmacy. Be it called Grover City or Grover Beach, and I'm not going to steal Gene's favorite line. I'm going to let him tell you that one. The Bellows have been proud business owners and citizens of our community for almost 50 years. Over the years, they have continuously supported the city, the Clark Performing Arts Center, and the Exploration Station, among others. And most recently, the Bellows gave a $500 donation that will be used to offset some of the costs associated with youth activities at the city's holiday celebration. Approximately 20 years ago, they served as Grand Marshals for the Grover City Christmas Parade, and most recently, in 2010, they were selected as Grand Marshals for the Grover Beach Holiday Parade. I think it goes without saying, Gracia and Gene, you have left your mark in this community, and that we should all be very thankful, not just this council, but folks who live in this wonderful community. You have been truly and are truly one of a kind. It is definitely my honor, and I'm sure my colleagues will have a lot more to say besides this, but I wanted to acknowledge you and all that you have meant to this community, being part of that foundation that has put us on the right path. And this is in recognition of appreciation for your many years of service and contributions as civic pioneers and business owners to the city and residents of Grover Beach. So would you all join me in giving Gene and Grace Bella a warm...
this beautiful place that we're living in. And thankful to be here. But Gracia worked in Escondido, California, down south, and all through high school in a drugstore, pharmacy, and then she went on to school. We met at school, and but when we graduated, we were looking for places to go, and we went to Chowchilla for a year, and then we went to Escondido, and I started to work for the drugstore that she worked in. And by that time, we had our first son, and one day, the proprietor there, Webb was his name, Beebe, he invited us out to his house. And Grace and I went out, and he told us that his brother, who lived in Grover City, which I didn't know where that was, wanted to sell his store. And he thought it would be good for us. And so I got on a bus in Escondido and drove. The bus came to Grover, and Mrs. Beebe picked me up in Arroyo Grande at that time, and I worked for them for the first week of that week. I worked for them and to see at the store. But on Thursday, I phoned Gracia and I said, "This is it." To this day, we talk about that. And we're indeed blessed to be here. Thank you very much.
So, Gene, I left you your favorite line. What he always tells us is he likes to joke that they had a business for 38 years in Grover City, and they retired in Grover Beach. Truly, truly, thank you so much for everything you've done for this community. So, any comments to my right?
Oh, thank you. Well, I'd just like to say thank you very much. I've always appreciated your participation. You've always been involved, and what I've really appreciated is your common sense, and just thank you so much. This is long overdue, but we appreciate you very much. Thank you.
Well, I would like to compliment them on what they've accomplished. I am very fortunate because when I moved to Grover Beach, we happened to buy a home that's right across the street from the Bellows. I couldn't have picked better neighbors if I had tried, believe me. You are such wonderful people, and we have enjoyed your companionship, your friendliness, and what you do for Grover Beach. Thank you so much.
To my left.
Well, I've been most impressed by your story about how you gathered together the lots to create Mid-State Bank. And I think if we could recreate that now, even 50 or so or less years later, we'd be doing very, very well. And also to let you know that your stamp of approval is highly regarded. Thank you.
Phyllis?
Yes. Thank you for helping to create a great city.
Very good. Peter, yeah, sure. Let me acknowledge former mayor and councilmember Peter Keith.
Thank you, John. I built my home in Grover Beach in 1977, and there weren't very many homes on the hill. off of Charles and North 6th Street. And one of my longest neighbors, and still neighbors, are the Bellows. And so I've known them all through, or most of the history of theirs through Grover Beach. I think the most interesting thing, however, is this, and that is that in the early 90s when we wanted to, or some of us wanted to, change the name of the community from Grover City to Grover Beach, we did it at the council level, and as I recall, it was a unanimous vote. I will tell you that the most gracious people in town were the Bellows. They didn't think it was the right thing to do. They didn't jump up and down and call people names. They didn't act improperly. They were totally and completely gracious about it, which is, I'm sure, is what you're named after. They came to council and said in terms that everyone understood that they thought that this was an issue of such importance and significance that it should go to a vote of the people. And they collected a petition. Thank you. They took a petition around and they got significant numbers of names, and subsequently it did go to ballot. That
and Gracie were not necessarily opposed to the name change. They just wanted to make sure that the citizens had a vote on that. So always thinking of the community first. So thank you so much. We're deeply indebted. So we're going to move on to item number two. And this is also a mayor's commendation honoring longtime community members and business owners Travis and Catherine Evans. And I had the pleasure of meeting Travis and Catherine, oh my gosh, 12 or so years ago. And Catherine has always been such a sweetheart. So longtime resident, and in the early 1960s, Travis helped build the Grover Beach Community Church on Ramona Avenue between 8th and 9th Streets. The two buildings, one the church and the other the parsonage, were chapels brought from the dismantling of Camp Cook military base in Lompoc. Colonel Ben Jacobs of Arroyo Grande and attorney Clifford Clark of Grover Beach were instrumental in acquiring these two buildings. Travis joined with several local folks who all helped build the recreation hall on Trouville that's now known as the Grover Beach Community Center with some of the Camp Cook surplus. The volunteers on that project included Joe McGowan, Ford Davidson, Lloyd Qualls, Henry Stutz, Alf Mintz, and the Beck brothers, and there were many others. In 1959, Travis and Catherine bought the T&G Market at 834 Grand Avenue in Grover City. They rented one of the buildings to the Grover Street and Water Department. Morgan Page was a foreman with one full-time employee. The city rented the building from them for several years. And in 1965, Travis and Catherine closed the T&G Market. Eventually, the property became the Lighthouse Fish Market, operated by Travis and Catherine's daughter, Jan, and her husband. And later, after another daughter, Susie and her husband ran the fish market until 1993. Today, daughter Jan now owns Lickety Split Cupcakes and Gourmet Bakery in Grover Beach. And I know another daughter, Carrie, worked many years for the city of for Grover City and then Grover Beach. So good to see you, Carrie. So Travis says, and kind of the joke would be every time I would talk to Catherine, I'd say, well, where's Travis? And she'd say, he's out fishing. So for the longest, I was sitting there thinking that, you know, maybe she was making Travis up. But he is a lifelong fisherman and fishes to this day and well-respected in that realm as well. He's continued to fish all these years. They've raised a family of four boys and four girls. And in June 2012, Travis and Catherine celebrated 70 years of marriage. So this goes on and on. Catherine has been a PTA president, a harbor commissioner, a campfire girls leader, and has worked as a fish fillet instructor. And they have just been wonderful members of this community and helped build the foundation to what I believe is a wonderful community today. And my own personal story with the fish market is, before I had even met them, I remember I had been running errands in town, and I went by the fish market and left my wallet on the top of my car with all my money and all my ID in it. And after searching frantically for half the day, I retraced my steps, went into the market. They had my wallet with my ID and all the money there. And it was a story I'll always remember that I'll take with me. But Travis and Catherine, it is my distinct honor, and I'm sure the honor of this council, to present you with this commendation tonight. So this is in recognition and appreciation for many years of service and contributions as civic pioneers and business owners to the city and residents of Grover Beach. So please come forward, and please give them a warm welcome. And one thing you all also need to know, that Catherine served 15 years on the election board. So,
okay. Since I don't hear very well, I hope all that you said was true. all those years, and only open, I don't know of a place that I would rather be. But I thank you for the commendation, and I must tell you, it was George Washington that supposedly said to his father, "I cannot tell a lie." You remember that? Well, I'm saying I cannot tell a lie. We enjoy the accolades. Whether we deserve them or not is another thing. And then I want to quote one other famous person, for in the New Testament, in Luke chapter 6, the 26th verse, says, Beware when all men speak good of you. And that was Jesus himself speaking. So thank you for your commendation, but I don't want to be higher than anyone. In Philippians it says, don't esteem yourself higher, but put the other person first. And that's what we'd like to do. Thank you, and thank all of you.
Thank you, Travis.
Is it all right if I preach a message?
Absolutely.
And the good stuff.
Do you guys have anything you want to add?
Yeah. Funny. Very funny.
Well, outstanding. And Travis, I had to tell you, when you and I met a month and a half or so ago, and we were talking, and you were telling me all the wonderful things, the light bulb came on, and I just thought, you know, to myself, we need to honor and pay tribute to those who have, in fact, given substantial contributions in this community, resources. My only wish is that I had done it sooner. But, you know, we've started this program, and I'm pretty certain the council will continue doing that, because we have numerous individuals in this community who have contributed greatly to this great community. So, again, to Gene and Gracia, to Catherine and Travis, thank you so much. We really appreciate it. Okay, very good.
Actually, I'd like to say something.
Okay, Phyllis?
I'd like to say thank you for being here, because now we have a really great cupcake store.
Yes.
And it has great baklava.
Mm. Well, we should have requested some of the cupcakes, huh?
Yeah.
We'll be in to see you. Okay, let's move on to our presentations this evening. This is item number 3 on the agenda. And this is a presentation from the Grover Heights Elementary School fifth graders regarding Grover Beach promotion. And I believe this is under direction of Ms. Betsy Erger, correct?
So good evening, everyone. This is Zach Nichols. He is one of 25 fifth graders who I work with for one hour every week. His grandmother is actually the teacher, Ann Nichols. But we were doing a program, I guess we could say, about bias and propaganda. And we decided that we were very biased towards Grover Beach. We really liked living here just because, like so many people that have, you know, that have done so much for this community. So not only did we learn about bias, but we also learned about propaganda. And we decided that we would do some flyers and some brochures in order to promote Grover Beach. And they were so good, I thought I would just bring them to you guys and present them to you, because this is a really fun little book we put together. Zach designed the cover. Wow. So I'm going to have him bring it up to you. Take it to Mayor Schultz. And thank you for allowing us to have this time to come. The kids are on vacation, so unfortunately there's only one instead of 25. But thanks for this time.
Wow. Thank you. Well, we will cherish this. I'm going to pass this down so they can look at this. And, Zach, one thing I want to let you know, that your grandma taught both my daughters in elementary school. I think fifth grade, right? Yeah. So she's been doing some great things in this community. She's definitely made an impact in my household. So, but we really appreciate this effort. And this is usually something we have to spend a lot of money for. So we appreciate the ideas anyway. Okay, thank you, Betsy. Okay, next we have a presentation by San Luis Obispo County District Supervisor Adam Hill regarding the John W. Callahan Heart Safe Project. Supervisor Hill.
Good evening, Your Honor and Honorable Counsel. Adam Hill from your
department. A victim's chance of survival is reduced by 7 to 10% with every minute that passes without CPR and having an automated external defibrillator accessible within 2 minutes, which was the key link in the chain of survival that was missing the day that my husband died. It is estimated that early access to AEDs could save up to 40,000 lives per year in the United States alone. These compelling statistics are why I know there is a great need for AED placement in our community. Thus, I formed the John W. Callahan HeartSafe Project, which has been established to provide our local communities with these life-saving devices. Our mission is to establish awareness, education, and immediate access to automated external defibrillators, AEDs, throughout our community, so that San Luis Obispo is a heart-safe county and city. And that also includes our North County family and our South County family. The project has been over a year and a half in the making, and there have been many people that have contributed to this project. I have a wonderful committee. I have been very lucky in the YMCA allowing me to be a nonprofit by being my fiscal agent, as well as getting a generous donation of 4 AEDs initially in memory of my husband, 2 by Sierra Vista Medical Center and 2 by French Hospital. One has already been placed at KSBY. One has been placed at Tartaglia Realty downtown. The other one has been placed at the San Luis Obispo Chamber. And tomorrow, the fourth one will be placed at the Avila Lighthouse. Through the generous through generous donations as well, a generous grant from PG&E, and also the support of Supervisor Hill and the other supervisors, I've really been able to make something that was actually a dream of my husband's, was to place AEDs in our community. So I want to thank you all for allowing me to speak here this evening, to see my husband's dream come true, to have the opportunity to make our county and city heart safe. There are brochures on the back of the table if you're interested in how you can contribute to the John Callahan HeartSafe Committee, and there's going to be a great
event on February 16th of 2013 that by San Luis Obispo City Fire Department, and I hope you can all attend. Thank you so much.
Very good.
Hello, Tom Huey, Five Cities Fire Authority. I'm a fire captain here. I've been here in this community for almost 15 years now. This project, the Callahan Heart Safe Project, has really taken off in our communities. And I've been working on this program. Actually, Five Cities Fire Authority has been working on this program for approximately 3 years to get AEDs placed in our local government buildings. Actually, Supervisor Hill has helped out by donating AEDs, as well as other folks in our community that's given to our project. And it's a real honor for me to turn over our project that what we started here to Lynn's group. This is a great group, and we're hoping to get more donations to get more AEDs into our local community, not only in our government buildings, but also in private businesses throughout Grover Beach, Arroyo Grande, and Oceano. So, yes, it's been an honor working with these folks, and I thank you guys for supporting this. Just so you know, our AED that's located here has been turned over to be replaced with one of the Lens AEDs, and that should be showing up here any day. So you'll be seeing that out here. And just for city staff that we also provided this free CPR training for, it's still the same type of procedures that you'd use. It's just a different manufacturer. And we also have a couple other AEDs to place in our government buildings here in Grover Beach. And I'll be meeting with city staff to make that happen. So, okay, any questions at all?
Thank you, Captain Healy. Okay.
Say real quickly that Lynn's done a great job. As you know, I was happy to be able to provide some for the city here, and also, you know, spoke with Lynn over a year ago because I also wanted to provide some for Slow City and some other places. Provided one in Pismo, but there are challenges, and you want to make sure that everybody basically has the same units and that there's a protocol for inspection and maintenance and all those things, and there's also liability concerns for private interests. So Lynn came back a year later and had all the answers and had a committee and had everything done. And so now this project has really taken off. We're really pleased to be part of it. I know my colleagues are pleased to be part of it in supporting with our community funds to make sure that throughout our entire community here, our entire county, we have as many of these life-saving units as possible. I'll look forward to continuing to partner with Lynn so that Grover has continued coverage throughout, not just our public buildings here, but we want to see some in our busy areas and Grand Avenue and down by the train station.
Be in a private business, you become part of what's called a public access defibrillator program, and I have partnered with a company called Cardiac Science. They are the manufacturer and also provide this public access defibrillator program. And as Supervisor Hill alluded to, you have to meet certain requirements that comply with the state of California Title 22. And we've been able to do that through this public access defibrillator program. So what I do within that also is offer CPR and AED training. Wherever an AED is placed, at least one person in the business per AED needs to be trained. I always say everybody needs to be trained in CPR and AED. Mm-hmm. It is a $90 class, and it is certainly priceless. There will be a time when one of us in this room will use that training, so it is definitely priceless. And you can get it through the American Heart Association, through the American Red Cross. You can just go online. If you take my brochure in the back, you can connect with me and call me. I'll be happy to direct you. And I have 21 people right now waiting on a list. I've just been able, through the generous grants with the PG&E and the supervisors, to order 16 more AEDs. And so through grants and donations, it gives me that opportunity to place them in as many businesses as I can to really make us a heart-safe community. And I've developed these little pins that show that we're a heart-safe community. I'll leave some here for this evening, and hope you wear them proudly.
Thank you. Very good.
Mr. Mayor, if we could get a quick photo with all of the council and Lynn, just she'll put it up on her website, which I'm sure she'll announce.
Yes, the website is www.kcfc.org. CallahanHeartSafeProject.org. And again, it'll be on the, it's a long name. My son kept telling me, Mom, you got to make it shorter, but I just couldn't. So he developed a beautiful website, and I'll be happy to put this up on our website. Thank you, Adam.
You want to come home?
Oh, we come down? Okay.
Okay, so moving on, let's go to our public communications. This is an opportunity for any member of the public to address the council for a period not to exceed 3 minutes total on any item of interest within the jurisdiction of this council. Please bear in mind that the council cannot take action on any item that is not on the agenda. So this is your opportunity to make comment on anything that is not on our agenda this evening. Is there anyone that would like to address the council doing public communications? Supervisor Hill.
If I could, thank you, Mr. Mayor and Honorable Council. Adam Hill again, your representative from the Board of Supervisors. Just a couple of things real quickly. Tomorrow on our agenda, we'll approve, I think, $2,400 that I've appropriated working with the mayor, city manager, and your Parks and Rec for our holiday parade. And I just twisted some arms so I could be a judge this year. Not just in, you know, I'm usually in it, but then I get to I miss the, you know, when you're in the parade, you miss the whole parade. You just see your car. So this will allow me to see everybody in the parade, including the marching bands and all the kids, which is great and my pleasure to help with this great South County tradition. Also, I will try to come back for the 3rd for when. We'll have the swearing-in ceremonies, but I congratulate the next mayor, Debbie Peterson, Karen Bright, and our councilman-elect, who I see is already busy, Jeff Lee. And I wanted to say something about Mr. Scholes. I'm sure next time that'll be said, too. He's done an enormously terrific job as mayor of the city here, as mm-hmm. I think most people know. He's been an incredibly effective leader at the Council of Governments and the RTA. Most of what you see, especially the improvements from the railroad station up to up Grand Avenue and the 4th, would not have happened if it wasn't for John's leadership. Mm-hmm. You know, 2 terms as president of COG, which we were all supportive of. We would have kept him as president of COG probably every year if we could have, because he did such a good job. But he was an extremely strong advocate for the city in many of our regional places. But that one,
people out of the water. One of the worst beaches was Port St. Louis, and as you know, and as I brought to the council before, Surfrider has our water testing equipment in the Avila Sea Life Center, and we set it as a long-term goal to work with the county to clean up Avila Lagoon, where they have permanent signs posted for people not to swim there. And so the message that I brought to the county is, this isn't the 1970s anymore. We need to do a better job. A lot of tourists are focused on that area, and Surfrider's here to help. The sanitation district, we're looking forward to new leadership there at South County Sanitation District. The plant continues to struggle. Multiple violations coming out of the plant almost on a monthly basis. So it's obvious that a plant that was built in the 60s is going to need a major upgrade. And we'd like water recycling to be a part of the plant's new design and think about relocation of the plant away from the coastal zone. We'll be addressing the same issue with the Coastal Commission having to do with the Morro Bay plant and moving that away from the coastal zone and the rock and then incorporating the water recycling into that. And that'll likely take place in either December or January, so perhaps in San Francisco next month. Last week, we were in Santa Monica having to do with the PG&E seismic study, and the plan was to do high-energy testing, which included cannon blasts in the coastal environment, and it would have had a major impact on our wildlife and potentially on people as well. And so Surf Rider, along with many other groups here in the county, mobilized about 120 people from here to get down to Santa Monica and to urge the Coastal Commission to deny the project, and we were successful. So what we'd like to ask PG&E to do, and also the county in working with Supervisor Gibson and others, is to kick the peer review committee into motion and find alternative technologies to the cannon blasts that are also utilized by oil exploration. So if we can find an alternative that can give us reliable data that'll help us be safe from potential dangers of Diablo Canyon, maybe we can utilize the same data in oil exploration and save our world's ocean from cannon blasts as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Brad. Is there anyone else? Okay, seeing no one come forward, I'm going to close public communications. And why don't we do this? Let's take a 10-minute break. We'll reconvene at, let's say, 7:25, so about a 12-minute break. Development permit application number 1207, 920 South 10th Street, and I believe staff report, Mr. Buckingham.
Good evening, Honorable Mayor Scholes and members of the council. The proposed project is located at the northwest corner of South 10th and Farrell, right here. The site is surrounded by other R3 zone properties to the west, north, and east. And to the south, the property is zoned industrial on the south side of Farrell Road. The proposed project does require approval tonight of a tentative tract map, use permit, site and architectural plans, and a variance. Project history. In 1998, the city actually acquired this lot, and it was used as a detention basin at the time. Subsequent installation of storm drains in the area eliminated the need for the lot to serve as a basin. In 2009, the council started to review city-owned lots for the potential development of affordable housing projects. And as a result, in May of 2009, the site was selected by the council. The lot was sold to the city's improvement agency with the intent of constructing an affordable housing project. In early 2010, the city issued a request for proposal to solicit interested parties in partnering with the agency to construct an affordable housing project. In May of 2010, the Improvement Agency Board authorized the negotiation of terms to enter into a regulatory agreement with the applicant, Vernon & Associates. And finally, in April of 2011, the Improvement Agency did approve the regulatory for Farrell Road. Here are the building elevations for Building 1, the south elevation facing Farrell Road. Here's the east elevation facing the courtyard or driveway access. Building 2 consists of four units. Unit B here is a two-bedroom unit. Unit C is a one-bedroom unit. And units D and E are three-bedroom units. Unit D and E both have two-car attached garages. Unit C, the one-bedroom, has just the one required car garage. And Unit B, a two-bedroom, requires two spaces. It has a one-car garage and then one dedicated surface parking space. Just to note, you can see unit C here. There actually, it's accessed from the sidewalk on Farrell Road up to the front entry here. Unit E would walk along the walkway on the south side with an entry here facing Farrell Road. The unit D, with parking in the driveway as well, would have a walkway that accesses along the north side with the entry here. And unit B has a walkway that accesses the entry on the north side here. Building elevations for Building 2, the south elevation facing Farrell Road. Here is the east elevation facing South 10th Street. Colors and materials, as shown, the architectural style, I would say, is contemporary. It does have a flat roof to keep the height down, and you see eave overhangs here. The exterior materials are a combination of both precision block, which is primarily at the base of the building down here in the gray. There's also a combination of stucco, horizontal siding, smooth panels, and you'll see the wood trellis and railing accents. And then the colors are shown down here, as you see. As far as public improvements, the project is responsible for constructing curb, gutter, sidewalk, and street form along the entire South 10th Street and Farrell Road frontages. The subdivision map would require a 5-foot dedication along Farrell Road to give it the complete 60-foot right-of-way width, and that would include the 5-foot sidewalk as well. All drainage is retained on-site in a combination of above- and below-ground basins here and here, here, and here as well. Again, underground storage as well. Lastly, based on the council-adopted policy regarding utility undergrounding, the project is eligible for a waiver of all undergrounding utilities because 100% of the units are designated as affordable. In general, the proposed project meets the development standards for the R3 zone and for the residential common area development standards as well. However, in this case, state law does mandate an applicant can receive or shall receive 3 incentives or concessions in return for constructing a project that has at least 30% of the units that are affordable for low-income households. And in this case, the project is 100% affordable. A development incentive, as defined by state law, is a reduction in the site development standards or a modification of zoning code requirements. And so those 3 incentives are an increase to lot coverage. The maximum is 35%. The increase would be to 39.5. This, in turn, creates a small decrease in the required landscape area. The second incentive they're seeking is to increase the maximum floor area of the second floor when compared to the first floor. Our PUD standards require that the second floor be 60% of the first floor. So in this case, you can see the second and third floors actually will exceed that 60%. And lastly, the third requested incentive is a reduction of the private yard areas for all the units. In addition to those development concessions incentives, the state also basically mandates a reduction in parking. They require only 1 parking space for a 1-bedroom unit and 2 parking spaces for a 2 and a 3-bedroom unit. They do not require guest parking spaces as our code would normally require. The applicant is also requesting a variance to allow the corners of the buildings to encroach into the required 10-foot street side setback along Farrell Road. All 3 locations that are highlighted, there are small encroachments into that street side. It's the reason that the commission could support the findings for a variance in this case was because of the lot's unusual shape, and it's larger than this, and the applicant has reduced them on this set of plans that was submitted late last week. And so I will let the applicant address their reasoning behind the reduction in the window size. And then the north elevation, as presented to the Planning Commission, has 4 windows. So the Planning Commission recommendation is that the proposed window locations are consistent with the land use policy related to privacy. In regards to solar access, the applicant did prepare a shade study to determine the amount of solar access to the property to the west in particular. This was provided at the Planning Commission meeting. The study indicates the existing dwelling to the west here would be in shade most of the year until about noon. This is at 10 a.m., so you can see the spring and fall equinox. The shadow extends over the south east corner of the subject property. A little bit harder to see, but at the summer solstice, you would actually have a shadow line that stops at about the property line. And then the winter solstice, the worst case scenario, if you can see that, the shade extends over the half of the easterly portion of the house. That was at 10 a.m. They did come back and subsequently provide in the city council packet the solar study at noon, so 2 hours later, again in the spring and fall then, no shadows. The summer, obviously, the best case scenario, virtually no shadows off of the site. And even in the winter solstice at 12 noon, there would be no shadows projecting on the west, the property to the west. So, again, the conclusion was that, yes, there will be shadows that will cast onto the western property up until approximately noon most of the year, but then afternoon would have full sun. And again, the commission recommendation here is that the project was consistent with the land use policy. The project is also consistent with the city housing element, which contains a number of policies encouraging affordable housing projects, including a policy to identify vacant underutilized properties for potential affordable housing projects, which is how we got here tonight, in essence. Policy 1.1 of the housing element addresses meeting or exceeding the regional housing needs allocation assigned to the city for the development of affordable housing projects or units between 2007 and 2014. This table's right out of the housing element. It indicates these allocation, the goal of the number of affordable units that we should provide. Here, this is the units to date. That includes the units that have been constructed, as well as the ones that have been approved by the commission or council but not yet constructed. And as an example, under the low, we have those six units to date. Those were the six units that were part of the Farrell Road tract, and that project is obviously not under construction yet. In conclusion, it's requested the council conduct a public hearing tonight and consider the Planning Commission's recommendation to approve the project. That concludes staff's report.
Thank you, Bruce. Nice staff report. Let me see if there's any questions. To my left. Okay. Debbie?
Yeah. I do have a few. I'm wondering if you could put up the east elevation again of the unit nearest the neighbors. And looking at that east elevation, I see that there are two obvious windows, but I'm wondering about the block to the right and above the garage. Is that a window or is it something else?
On the west elevation here?
The east elevation.
I'm sorry. This east elevation?
Yeah, that bit there.
So this is
there.
Facing the courtyard on the
right,
opposite side.
Right, I understand.
Side. And I believe this is a sliding window here.
Okay.
And a fixed window here and another fixed window here.
Okay, thank you. I couldn't tell what that was. So that takes away one of my questions that I was going to ask. One of the issues on the variance is that there are some conditions that it's not a grant of special privilege inconsistent with the limitations upon other properties in the vicinity and district in which the subject property is situated. And this is a tough one, and I don't know if you would even know this, but the units that are behind it on South 9th Street, did those have any variances? Are you aware that they had variances in order to fit into that particular lot?
I'm not aware of those. What we did look at, because of this property fronting along Farrell Road, and you have to consider only the R3 zone properties, obviously when this site was developed, it was quite large and it was subdivided as a PUD. And you can see this site as a multifamily project had considerable depth. And so they weren't unusual probably originally in their configuration because they were large and had deep frontages. The analysis of this one was that is the last remaining parcel along Farrell Road. Mm-hmm. You have something that's not only very small, but when you're talking about only a 29-foot depth on this particular side of the property, it certainly falls under unusual, and so hence the reason for the Planning Commission's recommendation that those findings could be made to approve the variance.
Okay, thank you. And let's see if I had any others here. I think that's pretty much it. Yes, that's all I had. Thank you.
Okay. Phyllis, you have a question?
Yes, I do. A couple questions. On the on our obligation to provide affordable housing, is there anything that defines what that affordable housing, how we provide it?
Well, the through SLOCOG, they assign those regional housing needs assessment. I would say that the goal and the reason the housing element was certified by the State Department of Housing and Community Development is because we have...
I have some other questions later, but I'd like to see also that... is there anything that requires that we have to build the units to certain sizes?
As far as square footage?
That's correct.
No. I mean, there are some minimum building code requirements but in this case, they would all exceed those.
My concern is... not to be offensive, but why is the one unit so large? 1,571 square feet, is that the living area?
It is.
Okay. You know, I know an awful lot of people that live in the city that buy their homes, and they have 900 square foot homes. So I wonder why it is that we are allowing this to be so large, this particular one. There might be ways of having this end unit be smaller, and then we would be not address the issue of the privacy intrusion or the solar problem if this particular last unit was made smaller and would only be two stories.
And I would defer to the applicant to perhaps answer some of that question as well.
I think that is a consideration that really should be looked at. Can you give me the square footage of the other units, please? Because it was not in this report. I looked several times.
And on the cover sheet, it breaks it down by floor, but unit A is 1,401 square feet. Unit B is 1,035 square feet. That's the two-bedroom. Unit C, the one-bedroom, is 767. And unit D is... 1,571, and unit E is 1,393.
Okay, thank you, Z. I find that, like I said, very interesting. I have a two-bedroom, and I'm in an 800-square-foot house. So I really think that we should maybe consider the fact that the unit on the end is too large, and that could be adjusted. And that also, I know that it was brought up about the land use element and those particular... Maybe I'll leave this for a comment period, but I do have the our brand new adopted, development codes here, and I also have our vision statement, and it seems to me that we are in violation with this particular project. So I will address those issues later.
Okay, so no questions. I think the only question you had is, in addition to asking for the sizes, is can the one unit be smaller? Okay.
Yes.
Move to my right. Any questions, Mayor Pro Tem? Karen?
I did have some questions. Oops. Got it. Thank you. I had some questions about the height. When I visited this site, I had a question about the property, the apartment building behind, directly behind the site. How tall is that building? Do you know offhand? Approximately?
It's a two-story building with a pitched roof. If I 23 feet tall.
Okay.
Would be my guess.
And the houses that are to the west of the site, would you say they're about the same height?
Again, two-story plates at 9 feet, that would get you 19 feet plus a roof pitch, probably again in that in the 22, 23 foot height.
Okay. And then this building, this project, is it? How is it going to be? How is it going to be set?
So the project does have some slope. There would be a retaining wall that would be built along that north property line. So there is a retaining wall that would be constructed along there up to about 5 feet in height. And we did look at the elevations and found that the site would be about 4 feet lower than the building to the west here. And then, this is, again, the site grading, the finished floor elevations, I should say, the ones. And this one, I think we said it varied from about 2 to 5 feet higher than the project site. Remember that building two has a step in it, so a portion of it is actually sitting a little bit higher than the units on the east side, or the west side.
That's building two, which is going to be... Over
two.
Here on
so,
the east side.
Yeah, I can defer to the applicant on the finished floor elevations, but I think there's about a 3 foot difference in elevation, finished floor elevation between those two. So, in comparison to a fixed finished floor over here, this one's going to be lower and this one 3 feet higher.
All right, so maybe those are questions I can ask the applicant then for more specific height questions. Okay, I think those are. Then I think I'll save my questions for the applicant. Then, thank you.
Okay.
For dedication came up, and that pushed us back even farther. And Commissioner Peterson, in response to the variance on the property line, that was one of the things we just could not get around. We tried to design around it, and we just were not able to. We were able to minimize it. It's probably only about 10 to 15 square feet that actually land within the side yard setback. But that's it. I'll wait for some questions, then I'll turn it over to Scott here with RRM to give a presentation on the architecture.
Okay. And Brad, I think there was a question of, I think they were talking about the one unit that's on the west end, if that could be smaller. Is that something that Scott will cover?
Yeah, I think Scott will cover that, but I don't believe that's the bigger unit.
Okay.
Mayor Schultz, Councilman, thank you so much for taking the time to really look closely at this exciting project. It's really a thrill to be an active part of this project. I think it's a good project for the community. I think, in general, looking at our infill sites are going to be the best way in which we can truly bring affordable housing to the communities here on the Central Coast. And like many of those infill sites, this is another one that does represent some challenges and some opportunities at the same time. So I'm going to keep my presentation short. I'll try to address the questions I did hear so far, but I'm more than happy to take any more. Again, my name is Scott Martin. I'm an architect at RRM Design Group. We've been working on the project with Brad for a couple years now. It was when he first came to us and said the development agreement was for five units on this site, we all drove down to the site to take a look and said, five units on this site. This is what affordable housing is. This is our opportunity to integrate into the city and be a part of a community. And we all got really excited about the project, to be honest. The first thing we did was really look at the community. We've got some photos over here. You really are in sort of an interesting juxtaposition here. You have R3 zoning, which allows for three stories, which allows for density. It is a sort of a niche area in Grover. And then directly across Farrell, you're looking at very industrial area of town. As you drive by, there's block wall, there's metal building, literally boxes out there. And so we felt this site was an opportunity for transition. How do you transition from neighborhood to an industrial setting in an R3 zone where there is a wide variety of housing that you can clearly see some progression over the years? And we really did a pretty thorough study of that. We looked at what the setbacks were required and what people have actually done. We've looked at how different buildings have become to mass themselves and orient themselves to the street, how they engage the street or turn their back to the street. And that's what led us to our site plan. The site plan we've been looking at, it's on the cover, it's on the second page in. When we started laying out the site plan, the most important thing to us was this is a corner lot. We wanted to make sure that these buildings really addressed the street. So even though there are more than one building on a site that has smaller, much smaller pieces of structure around it, we gave careful importance to every entry to make sure that it felt like a community. There is a resemblance of front porches. There is wood, warm members that are down at trellis height, pedestrian level, opportunities for each of the units to engage their street, to engage their neighbors. We are limited here. We do need to provide an accessible path of travel. Part of affordable housing does require that you have an accessible path of travel from the public right-of-way to every front door. That's why the one corner on the portion of building two is slightly raised in order to meet that accessible path of travel, but much like a traditional bungalow porch would be. Just as opposed to steps, we have a ramp from the driveway. So we're trying to take a traditional vernacular and a traditional problem-solving technique and apply some of these transitional architectural means and methods to that. We are, in every effort, trying to be as sustainable as possible. We're using an infill site, so right off the bat, we're creating less demand on infrastructure. We're also trying to harvest as much natural daylight as possible. So yes, windows, where they are windows, we try to make them large. We try to gain some of that southern exposure to use passive heating into the buildings, and we're trying to provide multiple windows into a room to provide cross-ventilation and allow for natural air conditioning as large, but they're still operable and allow for a breeze to come through. I think the privacy issue is much more an indirect line of sight now, while still allowing for these new homes to have a very quality livable space. The other issue I heard was height, and that's always been an issue. We wanted to make sure we were not asking for a variance there, so we are within the existing zoning requirements for height. However, our site, if you've seen out there now, there's quite a slope there now. And the way City of Grover calculates building height is based on existing natural grade. So we are 35 feet above existing natural grade, which means the neighbor to the north of us, who's 4 feet above us, then 20 feet, then has a pitched roof, by the time all is said and done, we're not really that much higher than they are from an overall building height. So I actually think the massing and the forms of the building will fit in rather well to the neighborhood. We do provide a retaining wall. Our second floor finished floor will just be slightly above the north neighbor. To address the unit size issue, there is no minimum set beyond what's allowed in the building code. I will say we have pinched these units, and they are not excessive by any means. I think a common misconception in housing is when you go to multiple stories, you're getting a lot more house. Oftentimes, you're getting a lot more stair. You have to provide vertical circulation for that, and it takes up square footage quite often. We've tried to arrange all units keeping livability in mind. So each floor on the second floor, that's really your kitchen, living, dining. That's the public area of your house. It's where you interact with people and socialize. The upper floors are bedrooms, and then two of the units have a downstairs bedroom in case there was a opportunity for a granny living situation or a separate office for someone who's working there. It provided for quality ground level space that is also partially dictated by the garage requirements here in the City of Grover. There are minimum interior dimensions for the inside of a garage. In an affordable project, we want to make sure our walls are stacking efficient structurally, and so that the garage size quite often dictates what's happening above. But I think you'd be surprised that 1,500 square foot, three-story building, by the time you take out stairs and circulation, mm-hmm. I don't think any of these will feel palatial by any means. So, again, I'm happy to answer any other questions or talk about materials, but I want to make sure we're addressing what it is you have to say. So, thank you for the opportunity.
Okay, hey, Scott. The question I had was on the precision block. I mean, that's highly unusual in residential. So, can you kind of talk about that?
Absolutely. Just 1 second. That's one of the things we pulled directly out of the neighborhood. We felt like it was a great transitional opportunity between the residential nature and the industrial nature of the project. It's a very durable material. It's very sustainable. You don't have to paint it every year. It lasts forever. It's got a good thermal mass. So it allows, as the south sun heats that concrete, it'll actually radiate heat back into the unit the rest of the day. So it's a good quality, sustainable material. It provides a real great base for a building, much like the old craftsmen's houses used to have stone or a rubble wainscot or base. This is a modern interpretation of a traditional building technique. Again, it's really nice and stable and clean. We've talked to Bruce about what that exact finish was, whether it was split face. So I think from a human scale, having a smooth block is nice. You're not catching your clothes. It's actually can be very beautiful. You'll see projects even in this area starting to use concrete block in residential projects all the time. It's a very durable material.
Okay, because I was going to ask a question about, did you consider split face or any other treatment on the
only
texture?
Issue with split face, literally, if I walk by with my sweater, yeah, it grabs on there, and it can become a little bit more harsh to the pedestrian. We're down there at the base, so it's a tactile experience.
Okay, and then someone had asked me previously if you had ever considered putting a project in just one building on the site.
Yeah, the requirements for garage access won't work due to the shapes of the site. So we are really dialed in here per our turning radiuses to meet city mm-hmm. requirements, backup space. Also for site detention, we're using both underground and we're trying to create rain gardens along the street. So it was a delicate balance. I think I've got 40 or 50 versions, Mayor Scholl, that I could show you. It is definitely a site we have studied, and to be honest, we're very happy with the results.
Okay, don't go very far. Let me see if there's anyone else had questions. Debbie and then Phyllis.
I had just one. I'm wondering if you feel
Osprey's there. I don't think, based on anticipated furniture layout, which I can never assure you of, I do not believe it'll be a privacy issue.
Any other questions?
Yes.
Yeah, Phyllis?
On that same west elevation, the stairs leading up, isn't that kind of an issue? Is there like a platform there that they would be able to be standing and looking into the neighbor's yard?
I think that's I'm a little confused on exactly which neighbor you're. Are you worried about the neighbor to the north?
No, I'm talking about the neighbor to the west of the unit that's detached.
So the stair that Mr. Buckingham's pointing out there, that one?
Is that for Unit A?
Yeah, and that's on the north elevation. That is not on the western elevation. So I don't think you could see the neighbor to the west from there.
Okay. Okay, just want to be sure about that. All right. And then I don't know if this is your issue or Mr. Vernon addresses this. There's a homeowner's in, correct? And who will be making sure that? Because I know that I have a friend who's in a really nice condo situation in Roy Grandy, and there are people who are just so uncooperative. And these are nice units we're talking about, pretty expensive ones. So how does it work with the homeowners and the CCNRs, if there is any?
Yeah,
and who's going to make sure that the vegetation is maintained, especially
okay.
out, visible?
Yep. Okay.
Yeah, so there will be CCNRs. The Homeowners Association will be actually controlled by the owners of the units.
Wow.
These are all going to be for sale affordable. I don't know if we actually, well, I guess Mr. Buckingham did point that out. They are going to be for sale affordable, so the actual residents will be the ones responsible for controlling the property. I believe there are minimum standards that the city sets for landscape. One of the other things we did with a lot of the materials, we're trying to use materials that will last for a long, long time. Again, with affordable housing, we're trying to make this truly affordable, not just an inexpensive sales price, but make it, in the long term, truly affordable for the residents.
Okay.
I hope that answers your question. Does it?
Not really, no. But that's okay. Okay. That's it for now.
Okay. Any questions to my right?
Not at the moment. Thank you.
Bill? Okay. Thank you, Brad. Okay. I do have two speaker request slips. Peter, is it Uzi? Okay. Peter, why don't you come forward, and then after Peter will be Jerry Ryu. Hey, Peter, you need to come and address us.
Sorry, I'm sorry about that.
That's
I just
okay.
wanted a clarification on one of the questions asked. Sorry about that. This is my first time before you.
Understand. No, understand.
And so I'm a little nervous. And,
yeah.
But I thank you for having me. My wife and I, we moved here about 3 years ago almost, and it was our first home that we purchased here in Grover Beach. I'm the resident at 911 South 9th Street, to the property to the west. There of building one or unit A, and we have two little girls and our primary concern and before the planning commission there was quite a deal of emphasis placed on the solar access, almost inordinately so, and what I'm really concerned about in addition to the solar access, which I still have conflict with, is privacy, specifically with regard to land use 3.1 subparagraph B, where neighboring buildings and outdoor areas, particularly where multi-story buildings or additions may overlook backyards or adjacent dwellings, is a requirement according to land use policy in order to be in conformity with the general plan, which is a dependency for the concessions sought in this project. And we've heard about the variances and why they're okay because, well, it's an awkward lot, so that's okay. Well, that also raises the question of what about all the unintended consequences? If it's such an awkward lot and an inordinately tall structure, I'm just very concerned about unintended consequences and the privacy that I'm going to lose and that my girls are going to lose, that we're going to lose. We play in the backyard there, and most of our residential dwelling and entertaining and living area is on our first floor, which is facing south here, which most of those windows are the only windows I have that receive sunlight. And we'll be in line of sight of about six windows on this building one. So, really, you know, and I appreciated Council Member Mulder's pointing out that this is about 1,500 square feet in building one. Well, I only live in about 1,200 square feet, and I too have stairs. And so, you know, one of my biggest concerns is the height of this building. I'm sure you've all. I would just characterize many of their findings with regard to the privacy issues and the land use violations as just mere assertions lacking due diligence and lacking justification and evidence. It's merely asserted that it doesn't really violate privacy. Okay. And that's kind of frustrating to me as a homeowner. I would just say that the burden's not mine to prove that. You know, I enjoy these rights, and I look to you, my elected representatives, to advocate for me. I only ask you to consider this. You know, when presented with a subjective matter such as privacy and solar access, there's going to have to be interpretation. But who better qualified to credibly interpret this than the homeowners who live adjacent to the property in question, who look over the lot, who play with their children in the soon-to-be-overshadowed backyard in question? Please put yourselves in my shoes as residents of this community. Ask yourself, is this the kind of policy that should be abstracted, depersonalized, you know, with so much talk of variance and awkward shaped lots? I mean, really, you don't really get a feel for the character until you're standing there. And this really just doesn't do the situation, the atmosphere justice until you're standing there, until you're standing in my home or in my backyard, or I'm sure my neighbors as well, who you've seen have signed the petition, who endorse my my concerns. But anyway, I just hope that we can apply all due diligence here and weigh this matter carefully, because we should get it right the first time, so that we can all be proud of, as a community, of the solution that we arrive at. So thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Great. And Peter, can I ask you, what was the clarification you asked for?
Councilman Mueller was asking about some stairs.
Uh-huh.
So I was wondering if we really resolved that. Because I interpreted her question perhaps to mean the front entry from the sidewalk.
Could you move towards the microphone?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I interpreted her question to mean maybe the front entry from the sidewalk. And from the plans, it appeared that front entry might be on the second floor. Are there steps going up to that? And that was my question for Scott.
Okay. So, and there are not, correct.
There are not.
Yeah.
Okay. There's
very good.
Is the front entry on the first floor or the second floor?
Okay. Why don't you ask the question, then I'll bring Scott back up.
Okay sorry. Thank you very much.
We have to make sure we capture it on the mic, and it's part of the record.
Okay.
So you can...
I'll chalk it up to experience now.
No, absolutely. Well, we really appreciate you coming down and,
yeah,
and expressing those comments and concerns.
Okay, appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Very good. So hang on to those answers, because I want to go to Mr. Ryu, and when everyone's done, I'm going to come back, okay?
Good evening, Mayor Scholes and members of the council. My name is Jerry Ryu. I'm the director of the San Luis Obispo County Housing Trust Fund. I'm here tonight to wholeheartedly support the Farrell Road Affordable Housing Project, because affordable housing is desperately needed in your community. While prices in our county have dropped quite a bit since 2006, when the median county home price peaked at $585,000, in September, the median in the county was 392, still very high. We were the sixth highest county in the state. We're the 10th least affordable housing market in the country. Boston is cheaper than we are. Hawaii is Honolulu is cheaper than we are. When you look at the difference between the price of housing and local incomes, the county was 392. In September, Grover Beach's median was 365, just a little bit lower. The homes that are proposed in this project, the highest home will be half that price, $184,000. The one and the two bedroom units will be less expensive. These homes will be affordable to families that earn $40,000 to $60,000. They're going to have a chance at the American dream. Given that the median income in Grover Beach is about $50,000, I think this project is a perfect match for your community. I've worked with most of you over the years, and you must agree that it's almost impossible to build affordable housing in Grover Beach and most of the county. There are a very limited number of sites available. Neighbors don't like change, no matter what. When affordable housing is proposed, people assume that it's going to be Pruitt-Igoe or something equally bad, old public housing. This is a wonderful project. It provides a great opportunity for your community and for your residents. I hope that you do approve it today.
Thank you. Thank you, Jerry. Good to see you.
And, the previous window of mention is up on the third floor. Again, I don't think it would have access to the neighboring outdoor space from a view potential.
And if I'm understanding this floor plan that Bruce has got the cursor on, that's the bedroom that's got the window that's up high.
You know what? And that's my fault. I apologize for that. There's this weird thing in our computer software where if you put a window too high, it won't show up because a floor plan's an actual slice through the building. So that window is right there where Bruce is showing that. And in an effort to accommodate what we had heard from Planning Commission. I should have done a little more double-checking of my plan set there. So
basically it's up high and it's not necessarily at eye level is
exactly
what you're saying.
Exactly. It's something that's intended to go. That's the anticipated bed wall. That's what we call it, where you put the headboard of the bed, but you'd still get some natural light.
Great. And then I think I see, is that a closet up top?
That is correct.
Okay. Very good.
Any other questions?
Thank you. Okay, if there was, I didn't see anyone. I don't have any other speaker requests form, so I'm going to close this to the public and bring this back to the council. So let's have some discussion. Let's see. Deb, you have any discussion?
Yes, I certainly came to this with a lot of questions, and I do understand the issue of privacy and solar access and the variance, and I think those are the findings that are troublesome. And having looked at it, though, and listened to staff's report, when I look at the overview of all three lots, I think that the two adjacent lots are equally as dense in terms of housing, and or more so even possibly. And so I don't think that it is unusual for the neighborhood. I don't think it's overkill for the neighborhood. And I do agree that being the very last lot there to be filled in, that as such, it is necessary to make some very small concessions to create the housing there in that R3 zone. So I would be in favor of going forward with it, with the changes that have been made to make the one window in the bedroom higher and to reduce the size of those windows.
Okay.
On the east elevation, west elevation.
Very good. Phyllis?
I serve on the Housing Trust, and I understand the need for low-income housing, and I have no problem with developing low-income housing. My only problem is that the height. And I really believe that we're in a way violating our own land use element here and our own zoning, not zoning, but our development codes. Because if you look at on page 211, which is 2.20.050, section B, it talks about that everything needs to be consistent with land use policy. Where neighborhoods are primarily single-story, two-story housing may be permitted. All multifamily development and large group family facilities should be compatible with nearby lower-density development or even, it says, infill projects. And I feel that this is just too tall for the rest of the neighborhood. I really think it does violate that. And I believe it also violates the privacy and the solar access. I'm a person who has solar panels at my house. I mean, what if these people later wanted to put such a thing onto their home? They would have an extreme problem because your solar time is from 10 to 2. Okay? And they're talking about there being a problem with the light at certain times of the day. And it says here that new buildings should be designed to respect the privacy and solar access of neighboring buildings and outdoor areas, particularly where multi-story buildings or additions may overlook backyards of adjacent dwellings. And I believe this violates that. If we say yes to this, we are violating our very codes that we have put into effect. And I really think that we need to really think seriously about this. I don't know why they can't just be two stories. I mean, I understand the garages. Perhaps that's it. And then, you know, in our vision statement, I wasn't around for this. It says here that early in the visioning project, participants agreed that Grover Beach's existing residential neighborhood should be preserved. If we go and we start changing the character of our residential neighborhoods, we are not preserving them. So I really find this to be very distressing that we are allowing such a large building to be put into an area that doesn't have comparable buildings in it. Thank you.
Okay. Karen?
Thank you. Well, it's an R3 site. It's an R3 neighborhood. And when I looked at it, it has two neighborhood. I live in R3 in an R3 district, so I know what it's like to have housing that does shadow my house
for certain hours of the day. And that's what it's like when you live in an R3 district. So I believe that it is consistent with our land use element. So I don't believe that it is appropriate use for that site. So as I think I think it looks like a really good project. I mean, considering all the constraints that you've had to work with, I appreciate that you've worked with the neighbors. It seems that you seem to have a relationship with them, and I hope that you will continue to do that, work as closely as you can with them. I understand the privacy issue. I have that myself with my neighbors, and we do try to work with each other so that we're not staring in each other's backyards and in their windows and so on. But that is what, as I said, that is what you have when you live in an R3 neighborhood. So I would be in support of this project.
Okay. Bill?
I have a couple of questions and comments. Number one, I do have a question that nobody has brought up yet, and that is concerning the $120,000 that we have apparently are in jeopardy of losing. And in the staff report, it states that the successor agency and developer will need to review if we lose that. And I understand that's still up in the air, and we won't know that for a while. But on the basis, if we were to lose that, insofar as the Department of Finance is concerned, the successor agency and the developer will need to review options that might be available to move the project forward without the agency's commitments. And I don't know, nobody has broached that subject yet, and I think we need an answer to that as to what is going to happen if that money and the Department of Finance says no, that we can't have this successor agency. Where do we go from there, and what are the options?
City Man.
Okay. Yes, Mr. Mayor, and as you know, on Wednesday we're heading up to meet with the Department of Finance. What's likely to happen is we won't get an immediate decision. And if the decision that we get, we think we have a good argument, first of all. Secondly, if that argument goes against us, we still have the option of an appeal. So we would still go through that process. Finally, if obviously, and the city attorney may be able to help me out here, but if the Department of Finance and the final decision is that agency cannot support these obligations, then the property is still retained by the successor agency, and the successor agency would have to find a way to dispose of it. One option might be to find a third-party buyer that would be able to work with us in putting the project forward. It's just an idea or a concept, but it's one that we have. I've given some thought to. The other is, if you take the action tonight, the project will be entitled, and that means that it can be built at some point by some developer, certainly. So those are just a few of my thoughts. They're not conclusive because they can't be at this point until we get to the end of the process.
Okay. And
No, you have the floor.
In the agreement, it says that the developer, under the regulatory agreement, it says that the owner's obligation to the financing, the owner is obligated to obtain financing necessary to the completion of the project and provide proof. Does that include the $120,000? Does that exclude the $120,000? Where are we on that?
Honorable Mayor, Council Members,
yeah, City Attorney.
Thank you. A couple of things. It does not include that the agreement obligates, at least as approved by City Council, supplements the development fees with the $120,000 from the LOMOD fund, as well as transfers the ownership to the, of the property. It would be my recommendation at this point in time that this item this aspect of this item, if in fact materializes negatively, if
couldn't put these five units in one building on this piece of property, instead of trying to have two buildings where we do create the privacy problems. So that still is a question in my mind, and if we don't resolve that, then I don't think I'm going to be in favor of this project.
Okay. So, Phyllis, you have a question?
I would actually like to have clarification on what we just talked about with the Department of Finance, because my understanding was it was just had to do with the $120,000 with the fees. I didn't realize it had to do with the actual ownership of the property.
It does.
And so could you clarify that again? Because the way you explained it before was not quite, I didn't quite get it completely.
Okay.
The obligation of the regulatory agreement includes both the transfer of the property once the project is completed plus the processing fees.
All right, thank you.
And that's an agreement that had come to this council and had been voted on, correct? Okay.
I could.
So, okay.
I'd like to respond to Mayor Pro Tem Nichols. What was said in response to the putting it together as one building was that the garage requirements couldn't be met. And I think if we put it together in one building, if we could find a way to meet the garage requirements, it would be actually much more massing. And I think the way it's done now, it allows for some green space, it allows for some open space, and the massing is far more, far less overwhelming.
Well, it could be flipped.
Okay. So let me just make some comments, and then we'll see where we are with the motion on this. Let me just say, staff did a really good job of laying out all of the issues and presented that to the council. And I know this is something that's been going on for a long time. I certainly think it's a creative solution for a very difficult and challenging site. As someone who's got a little experience in this, I would certainly say a triangular site, given knowing the site the way it is certainly justified with the variance and meets the state required standards. With respect to the issue of privacy, I'm convinced that the way the building is designed, that has been addressed. And I'll tell you that when the 90 homes were built behind my house, we were concerned about privacy, and I live in a single-family neighborhood. They had raised the site from 6 to 9 feet, and so the house next to me is quite a bit higher, and so that those are sort of some things that happen when you're designing in close quarters, whether it's R3 or even R1 in a lot of instances. But I believe, given the orientation of this building, the bedroom that will have windows that are not at eye level, a closet that does not allow anyone to view toward that area, I think does adequately address the issue of privacy. With respect to the solar and shading, yeah, that's a concern, but I do have experience with the solar layouts that they did and showed that it would be minimized. I believe that is correct, because I do have some experience with that. And I know there's going to be some shadows on some of the properties, but for a short duration. And I'm not even sure if that would even preclude if someone really wanted to put solar panels on the adjacent homes. I think that issue has been addressed. With respect to general plan consistency, I mean, yeah, we can pick policies and standards that something may not agree with, but it may be in agreement with a majority of others. Land use density, I think Karen and Debbie pointed this out correctly, that it appears to be consistent with the density around the neighborhood. I'm convinced when Scott talked about transitional area, especially being across from an industrial area, that at some point probably would become even more intensified as time allows. I think this is a good solution to transition So I'm not concerned about that. Now, with respect to the housing element, and I think this council has had goals in the books for many years talking about trying to provide affordable housing, and we've done that in a variety of ways, and I'll just give you maybe two examples. On, I think, Brighton, between, I want to say, 14th and 16th Street, Gabe Ramirez came in. There were seven existing apartments. He added, I want to say, four, maybe five units, and he took a portion of the existing units, upgraded them, and made them for affordable housing. So that was done to where we had some new development, but they took some existing housing and converted it. And I believe Mr. Vernon actually did this in the project on North 16th, I'm sorry. There was an existing apartment building that was there's no authority over that. So I'm not going to go down that road too far. But I think overall, given the challenging site, given where it is, I think they've done a really good job with respect to design. I'm still not convinced on the precision block. You know, I still see precision block as something very cold, and I don't know how you address that. But I think for the most part, they've tried to address the issues, and we're not just wiping aside others' concerns because there is significant due diligence that's been done. So I think at this point, we need to see if there's someone prepared to make a motion on this item.
I'll do that as I get to the right page here. So I think we need to, I'm trying to find out where we go for this. We need to approve, or I'd like to make a motion.
Top of page 10.
Thank you for that. So can't find page 10 here.
Okay. Honorable Mayor and Council Members, I would recommend that it's taken on two votes.
Okay.
There are two resolutions.
Okay. So there's two resolutions, correct?
And I would recommend starting with the variance.
Want me to make a motion?
Yeah, go ahead, Bill. That would be good.
Okay. I move that we adopt the resolution approving the tentative tract map, use permit, and site and architectural plans.
I second that.
Okay, there's a motion and a second. Is there any discussion on the motion? Okay, roll call.
Yes.
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 No.
Yes.
And I will also move that we adopt the resolution approving the variance.
I'll second that also.
Okay, there's a motion and a second. Any discussion on the motion? I'm hearing none. Roll call.
Yes.
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 No.
Yes. Okay, so those two resolutions carry. So that was item 5. Why don't we move on to item number 6. This is a consideration of adopting the 2012 update of the multi-jurisdictional local hazard mitigation plan.
Mr. Mayor, Lieutenant Peters will give this staff report. Commander Peters, excuse me.
Your Honorable Mayor and members of the Council. First, let me apologize tonight. I am under the weather, so I apologize for my hoarse voice. But we're here to discuss the FEMA Local Hazard Mitigation Plan. In March of 2008, the cities of Grover Beach and Arroyo Grande, as well as the Lucia Mar Unified School District, entered into a hazard mitigation plan as outlined by FEMA. And the purpose of the plan is to identify each jurisdiction's vulnerability, to identify hazards, and ultimately reduce both human and financial losses to the jurisdictions in the case of a disaster. Each plan has to be updated every 5 years, so we are coming to that time in 2013 of updating this plan. So in 2011, staff got together in the jurisdictions, and we started working on updating this plan. We have brought that forward to you here tonight, and the cities of Arroyo Grande, Grover Beach, the Lucia Mar Unified School District, and this year we also included the South San Luis Obispo County Sanitation District had partnered in updating this plan and getting it ready for submission. The partners all agreed that the Five Cities Fire Authority would be the project manager for the plan, and I have with us here tonight Dave Matthey of the Five Cities Fire Authority, and he was the one who spearheaded as the project manager. So if there are any in-depth questions, he is available for those. The Disaster Mitigation Act of 2000, commonly known to as everybody to this 2000 Stafford Act, requires that local governments develop and submit mitigation plans in order to qualify for Hazard Mitigation Grant Program. The grant program allows local jurisdictions to access funds available for pre-planning for disasters, as well as also in response to disasters. It helps for making funding available in response to those disasters. Excuse me. Each of the participating jurisdictions provided input on hazard analysis, hazard mitigation, hazard identification, vulnerability assessment, and risk assessment. We also put the information out to the public through the Tribune newspaper, as well as the Times Press copy of the plan. The first thing is the zoning map used for the city of Grover Beach. If you notice, the zoning map is actually the old model. We did not actually put the new model in there. That is an oversight, and we will be getting that model in there, the new map in there. And item number two was the census figures for the United States Census, not necessarily the city census, but the United States Census were different in Arroyo Grande's portion of the plan than it was in Grover Beach's portion of the plan. That's just a mistake on our behalf of not proofreading both plans together. So we will get those updated with the U.S. Census figures that are currently in use today. And that's pretty much all I have to report. Any questions?
Any questions?
Comments? Yeah. No questions.
No questions.
I have questions.
Okay, Debbie.
Find my little list of questions. I believe that this is being presented as natural hazards. Is that right?
There are natural hazards as well as for such. In this particular case, there's earthquakes, there's fires, floods, dam disasters, which we have pertinent to us as well, but mitigation plans can actually be planning for any disaster. But this one just covers those four that we have in reference to our plan.
So the reason I'm asking is because I'm wondering what is, I believe there is a plan in place in the event of a problem at the nuclear power plant?
There is a separate plan in place for the nuclear power plant, yes.
Okay, so we don't need to address that. Also, I know that Oceano is county area, so how are we interfacing with, we've got Oceano and the South County Sanitation District, or Arroyo Grande and Grover Beach, or no, Oceano is not involved, is that right?
No, Oceano is
not. I guess I'm wondering how we interface with the county on all of this, because we're a homogenous community.
Yes, what we've done in the past, and I've been in attendance to several meetings of where the fire department, as well as the county fire and CDF, have looked at, particularly flooding is a big issue in Oceano, and they've looked at that plan and shared what some of the county's responses would be for that. But the county is ultimately responsible for that, and of course we would work with them very closely in any disaster. Any assistance rendered needed, one way or the other, we would assist each other.
Okay, and let's see. I know that the water table beneath probably near where the sanitation district is quite high, and so that in down in those areas of Oceano, my understanding is that there's a really high risk of liquefaction and greater damage. I just wondered if that had been taken into account.
Not in our plan. Our plan is specific for the city of Grover Beach.
Okay. So we're just talking about Grover Beach tonight.
That's correct.
Okay. Then that reduces the questions. Okay, no more questions then. Thanks.
Okay, Phyllis, any questions? Okay. On the, just had a question regarding, you were talking about the member agencies had been invited to participate and the council would need to make a decision which council member might be going back. I think I'm looking on page two. where it talked about planning partners have been invited to attend the National Fire Academy's Emergency Management Institute. Is there a time frame on that for this council to make a selection?
Actually, there is. December 11th of 2012, all participants will be required to attend a briefing at the Arroyo Grande City Council Chambers to receive information on how that training will be attended. So you do have to choose somebody to go back and so they can attend that briefing.
Okay, because
Honorable Mayor, Council Members,
yes.
That was one of the items that was on my notes, and nothing prevents you from if you desire to consider Council Member Elect in this selection process.
Okay, because I think what I was thinking is, I guess a natural would be whoever's on the Five Cities Fire Authority, and I know that the new council is talking about having committee assignments done. Mm-hmm. Maybe the first meeting in December. I don't know if we had future word from the county clerk on certification of the election, and I'm not going to go there until later. Okay. Okay. There's no other questions at this point, so let me see if there's anyone in the public that would like to address this item before the council. Okay. Seeing them, bring it back. Okay, so we're going to bring it back. Karen, I think you said you had a comment. You want to start?
I just wanted to say I really enjoyed the report. I liked all the information. I mean, I know it was supposed to be it was very informative, but it was also very entertaining.
life and even human in some cases, is that if we are able, and we have been on land, to do 3D mapping of the fault lines, we're much better able to do emergency planning because we know which bridges probably need reinforcement or which ones will fall down. We know better what's going to happen with the water line that extends the South County sanitation line that extends right about out to the fault line. So I just wanted to just raise that because that's a really important safety planning factor and also a future planning factor. It gives us a lot more information about can we stack our freeways or is that not a good idea in a particular location. So just wanted to raise that comment and put that information out there.
Okay. Phyllis, you have anything? So with respect to there's a couple of things I think that's not obviously captured in this plan, and this is obviously separate of. Were there to be a seismic event, there is, in fact, a jointly staffed emergency operations center and emergency operations facility between PG&E and the county, and there would be coordination with the various cities. So there are, in fact, plans out there. I would also say that there is a new evacuation time estimate study that is being worked on by the utility with input from the various cities and the county. And what they've asked them is to identify how quickly they can repair a bridge in their jurisdiction. So they've identified what are evacuation routes and said, okay, they've classified it with respect to its structural condition and how quickly it could be repaired. So there's information out there, and I would highly suggest that maybe going forward that maybe there's some information that staff can bring back to this council and really educate and inform them on existing plans that are out there. And I would even say with respect to this local hazard mitigation plan, I think these are great steps. But for South County, and I know I talked to Joe Costello about this, is that maybe there needs to be a joint exercise in responding to a hazard or an incident. So I think that's kind of something that the council member from Arroyo Grande does. But those are good things to bring up, and maybe that's something that you all can have discussion on after December 5th, I think. I did want to point out on page 10, I'm not quite sure where the information came from regarding the Grover Beach Hazard Mitigation Revision Planning Group. And I see that my name is down here as a council member, so I'm not sure where that information came from.
On page 10, the second column down, I believe, is what you're talking about?
Yes.
Okay. That I do not know. Chief Copsey was reaching out to everybody, so I don't know if he had talked to you about that.
Mr. Mayor.
Okay. Well, if he had talked to me in 2011 or 12, I was a council member, but I don't recall having that conversation.
What happened is we solicited interest, if you some of you may recall, in a Friday letter probably about 6 months ago, and didn't have anyone come forward and agree to do that.
So you volunteered me.
So I volunteered you.
I appreciate your honesty. So I don't know. Well, I just think going forward, you're going to have to make that revision somewhere.
I made it on that, yes.
Very good. Okay. All right. So at this point, someone prepared to make a motion on this item.
Well, I would move that we adopt the resolution adopting the 2012 update of the multi-jurisdictional local hazard mitigation plan. I'm not sure that we want tonight to designate one council member to attend.
So why don't we, you want to
just start with the first
delay
so
that?
So that's your motion,
right? That's
right.
My motion.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And I'll second that.
Okay, there's a second. If there's no discussion on the motion, roll call.
Yes.
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 Yes. And then I guess what that really means is with that motion that the new council will take up and identify and designate a council member to attend the Emergency Management Institute. Correct? Mm-hmm. We're good. Okay. So let's move to our consent agenda. This is typically an agenda where we take things that, routine items are considered as a group. We have, looks like 5 items on consent tonight. We've got the treasurer's report for the period of October 3rd.
Or would you like a full report?
I don't need a full report.
Okay, so let me see if, hang on a sec. Let me see, do any other members want to pull any items from consent? Okay. Okay. You just need clarification, because what I'm thinking is we can get that clarification
and then vote.
Take them all, or?
Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah, let's do that. Okay.
I just want clarification on the amount that we're going to reimburse, where that figure came from.
Sure. When we had originally proposed the original agreement, it was a complete offer of lease to them for no fee to the city. It was a dollar. They were going to rent from us for $1 a year. However, when they went back to their board, and they verbally had supported it, but when they went back to their board and reviewed the costs of their insurance plans and their maintenance plans, they were unable to support the final document. So staff believes that it would be a win-win if we supported them by reimbursing them up to that amount on the cost, the additional operation and maintenance costs that it would take for them to operate for the year.
Does this still put us in a positive position if we hadn't continued?
Well, we were paying approximately $15,000 to $20,000 a year operating it through the city completely. So it's been closed since April.
So why don't we do this? We probably should just pull this item.
And I just wanted clarification for the amount and how much we had been paying up, unless somebody else wants to know.
Are we okay? Mm-hmm. Okay. Does those clarify? You have others?
Questions? That was it. I just wanted to know where that is.
I just wanted to make sure if we were going to keep going, I thought it would be better if we just pull it.
I wanted the comparison of the two figures, please.
Very good.
Okay, I'll make a motion that we accept the consent agenda as presented.
I'll second that. Do we need to say that Councilmember Molnar is recusing? Yeah.
She already has.
Okay. I did.
She already has. So we've got a motion and a second. And if there's no additional discussion, I believe this, actually, we're going to do this as a roll call, correct? Yeah.
Yes.
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 Yes. Thank you, Donna. It was for that clarification.
And I'm recusing myself now for the next item because I live too nearby.
Oh.
My office is too nearby.
Okay, so we're going to move to regular business, and this is item number 12. This is a request for waiver of public improvement requirements and bonding agreement for Verizon Wireless, 201 South 3rd Street Wireless Tower. And this is from Mr. Ray.
Good evening, Honorable Mayor and City Council. On October 8, 2011, the City of Grover Beach Planning Commission adopted Resolution Number 11-27, approving a coastal development permit for construction of a Verizon Wireless Communications Tower at 201 South 3rd Street. As a condition of approval, the applicant was required to construct new curb, gutter, sidewalk, and associated street conforms in accordance with the City of Grover Beach Municipal Code Section 9137.9. And that's included as attachments to your staff report tonight. Because the site is a corner lot, the improvements are required along two streets, as you saw earlier, actually, with the development permit application discussed earlier in this meeting. And that includes, and this project includes, one block along South 3rd Street and a single lot frontage along Rockaway Avenue. The municipal code also requires that the public improvements be completed prior to issuance of a certificate of final inspection. Verizon Wireless tonight is requesting a partial or complete waiver of the requirement to construct curb, gutter, sidewalk, and street conform improvements. In addition, Verizon Wireless is seeking council approval to bond for any remaining public improvement requirements so that they can receive their final inspection and begin operation of the wireless communications tower. City Council has the authority to waive all or part of the public improvement requirements. And they have that authority in cases where, in the sole discretion of the City Council, the strict application the municipal code requirements would create a substantial hardship, would be impractical, or would not be in the best interest of the city or the public. Attached to your staff report tonight is a letter from Verizon Wireless Counsel James A. Hurd. You may be aware of the Nolan Dolan case, which involved off-site improvement requirements on a project and that were deemed not to be associated with the impact of the project itself. So this is the claim the applicant's making. Your staff report includes a response from the City of Grover Beach City Attorney. And in summary, essentially the City Attorney reviewed the claim, does not agree with the application of Government Code Section 65909 in this situation. Basically, the City's requirement for curb, gutter, and sidewalk to be constructed along the street frontage of the parcel, in particular, is directly related to the project. That's not an off-site requirement. As an alternative to a full waiver of the requirements, Verizon is offering to pay for $50,000 in public improvements. Just to give you some idea of what that might amount to, if the high estimate of $200,000 for the public improvement were in fact the cost, be about one-fourth of the street improvements could be constructed for $50,000. Staff is recommending that council deny the request for a waiver of all or even part of the public improvements. However, staff is recommending that council approve the attached bond and agreement and undertaking for installation and construction of the public improvements, which are part of your staff report this evening. There's a couple of alternatives that staff has identified for council's consideration. They include, one, to deny the request for a waiver of all or portion of the public improvements, but approve the attached bond and agreement. Two, approve the request for a partial waiver of improvements and approve the attached bond and agreement for installation of the public improvements. Those that would not be subject to waiver anyway. Or three, approve the request for a partial waiver but deny the bond agreement and insist that the public improvements be completed prior to their operation of the tower, or four, provide alternate direction to staff. Again, staff's recommendation is that council deny the request for a waiver of all or even a portion of the public improvements, but approve the attached bond and agreement. And that concludes my presentation.
Thank you, Greg. Any questions of staff? Phyllis?
Okay, clarify the conditions of the bond, please. I read it, but would you explain it, please, for the listeners, how it would work?
Well, essentially, in the City of Grover Beach Municipal Code, it says a project is required to complete their public improvements before they can get their final inspection, which means they can't operate the tower, essentially, until they got final inspection and completed the improvements. Council has the authority to extend the period of time required to complete those public improvements. And the way you would do that is you would authorize an agreement and a bond, and the bond would cover the full cost of the public improvements, which would essentially guarantee through the conditions in the agreement that the public improvements would be constructed, and if they weren't, we would call the bond and do them ourselves.
So is there a time frame on this bond? Like, are they saying they'll do it within a certain period of time? Or
there's a time frame indicated in the agreement. I looked that up. I don't know it off the top of my head.
Okay. So they're saying if they don't complete it within 120 days, we can call the bond for $275,000?
Those are the conditions of the bond.
Okay. And then, so how do, so let's say they don't complete the improvements. How do we collect?
You call the bond. You get the money and you finish it yourself.
Okay, so it's guaranteed that we would get the money. That's what I wanted to know.
That is correct.
Okay. I know that a lot of people who build right now, they are required to do the sidewalk improvements or the gutters, correct?
And yeah, the project you looked at earlier is almost an identical site in a way. It's a corner site, and that project was conditioned for curb gutter and sidewalk improvements along both frontages. So.
And Verizon went into this agreement knowing that they were obligated to do this at the time that they got their permit?
Staff conditioned the project at the time that they applied for the development permit. So,
The resolution granting approval clearly states that and was signed by the applicant.
Okay. And so they're saying now they don't want to have to do it because of hardship, financial hardship?
They're claiming it would be a hardship, yes.
All right, thank you.
Okay. Questions, am I right?
I guess not.
So, Greg, do we know what's the valuation of this project? I mean,
$1,000. So at our low bid, this comes close to doubling our construction costs. To the point of knowing the scope of the work, when we came in for the conditions of approval, we didn't know the full scope of what would be required. The conditions of approval simply state that we would do curbs and gutters to the satisfaction of the city engineer. Once we had the plans approved by the city, that brought to light the full scope of work and the cost involved. So that's why we're claiming a hardship, I think, is because we were not aware of the full scope of the work, the engineering involved, and also the cost over and above what we had slated for construction of this site. So I can field any other questions.
Okay. Any other questions?
Yeah.
Okay.
When did you learn the full cost of the project?
We learned the full cost of the project in August.
August of this year?
Of this year.
When did this project start?
The project was submitted, I believe, in May of this year. Just checking my notes here, but I believe that's correct. I believe it was in May, yes.
Okay. Is there any reason that you know of why Verizon didn't alter their plans, knowing that they were going to have this as of August? They knew that they had to spend this extra $120-some thousand.
Alter in what way? I don't understand the question.
Well, if you say initially they thought the project was going to be about $150,000 project.
The project without curbs and gutters is $150,000 to install.
Then in August, you learned that it was going to cost an additional $125,000 or so.
When we had submitted our drawings to the city engineer and we went back forward to get approved plans, when those were finally approved by the city engineer and we took the work out to bid, that's when it came to light the scope of the additional curb and gutter project.
Okay, and I don't understand why you couldn't get the financing to go move ahead with the project.
It's not that we don't have the financing. We're claiming that because of the curb and gutter scope is much larger than we had anticipated, it presents a hardship because it doubles our construction cost.
Okay. The other question I have is then, if we proceed with the bonding, am I correct in understanding that the work will be completed within 4 months?
That's my understanding, and if it's not, then as City Council has suggested, then the bond is called, and
correct.
The city has the option of completing the work with the financing from the bond.
Okay, and from your perspective, is Verizon okay with that? Can they complete this within 4 months?
I believe they are. Again, I think that their preference, of course, is to waive the entire requirement or part of the requirement. However, in the worst case, well, not the worst case scenario, disregarding that, if the council can't provide that relief for Verizon, then they would request the bond and that they would approve that.
Okay, thank you.
Karen?
Well, I'm looking at your at the resolution that was signed by the applicant, dated March 14th, and it's pretty specific. New curb, gutter, sidewalks, and street conform as specified by the Grover Beach Municipal Code, section 9137.9. It's unfortunate that somebody didn't do their homework, I'm thinking. That, to me, is, I think, kind of a shame. So I can't read whose signature that is, but somebody has accepted the conditions, according to this resolution that went before from the Planning Commission. I'm just wondering who looks at these things for Verizon.
Well, I believe that who signed off on that was the construction manager on the project, probably not understanding the full extent of what the code required for curb and gutter, and in this particular location, the engineering and the street improvements as well. So I think that that's probably where the ball was dropped. If you could call it a drop the ball.
I'd say, yeah, big ball. Big ball got dropped.
Are we looking at a percentage on 3rd Street? I'm trying to get it.
It's essentially one block along 3rd and then just the property frontage along Rockaway. If you look across the street, for example, the development that was done across the street, which is the Joe's Buggy House, I believe, they constructed virtually almost the same extent, even though the lot was a little bit smaller on 3rd Street. But basically new curb, gutter, sidewalk, street conform along Rockaway and 3rd, and that development directly across the street.
But that was part of an actual building and a full development of the property,
full
right?
Site development, right.
Okay.
And in this case, you know, the street conform ends up being basically out to the center line of the street.
Yeah, I know it's not a very good street.
Yeah, it's just that the grades on the existing South 3rd Street aren't going to work well with the new curb profile, and the curb profile has to allow for drainage. So,
And so with this project, is there still development potential on that property?
Possibly someday. The Summerfields own the property that this site is on. It's a lease site on that property. Right now it has a small cabinet shop in the back, and then a roofing warehouse, and then an office and some storage on site.
Okay, great. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else that would like to address item before the council? Okay, see no one come forward. Let me close it to the public, bring it back to the council. Okay. Who wants to start discussion?
Well, I will. I think that we ought to allow the bond agreement. And I'm not sure that we should go along with the street there and along 3rd Street is in such bad condition. I'm not sure that we're proving anything by making them take care of the street out to the center of the street, right? Does that not leave half of that street still in shambles?
Some street improvements were done. A conform was done on the opposite side of the street when that site was developed. So there may be some portions of the street that remain in substandard condition, but it certainly the southbound direction would be in great shape.
Do we still have the option to have them pay in lieu of? Insofar as the street conform is concerned, I think the curb, my feeling is the curb and gutter should go in. Because the street in that area, and I've looked at it, it's in really bad shape. And I think doing half of the street right now is not smart, not good at all. Could we put some of the money into, in lieu of an account, and allow them to go ahead with the bond issue, which gives them 4 months to complete the work, which I'm not adverse to. I think they want to get that tower operating for the benefit of the company, and I think we should encourage that. It's a business in Grover Beach, and they're going to do well. I'd like to encourage them to get started as soon as possible and figure out a way to proceed with this. And if you disagree with me on the street conform, or if there's no way that we can do that technically, then I will suggest that we deny the request for the waiver and proceed with the bond.
Honorable Mayor, Council Member, from a standpoint of the code and what is options that are available, in lieu fee is not something that is an option in this particular instance. I will let Mr. Ray address the issue of whether or not curb and gutter makes sense without a street conform, but the other side of the street was done to street conform in conjunction with a project that was completed there, and I don't remember how long ago. So this would be the second half of the street that would be a street conform. Your options today with regard to the request are either grant the full waiver, grant a partial waiver for some of the work not being done, or deny the waiver and grant the bonding. The in lieu fee is not a option that is available.
Thank you.
Okay.
Yes. So, go ahead.
Well, so the way I see this is, and I understand, just to blanketly look at this and say, hey, it's Verizon or we haven't done this for anyone else and don't waive the fees. But I'm sitting here looking at this, and so it's a kind of a fairness argument. Because I'm also looking at this when I see what they're constructing on this larger lot that still has some development potential. I'm just wondering if it does make sense to look at some sort of waiver, not a full waiver, but to, and I know they suggested $50,000, and I know in the staff report you're saying that you don't know what that would be for. So, Greg, you have anything?
Okay, yeah, a couple things. I think it would be appropriate to talk to the technical feasibility of doing curb, gutter, and sidewalk without street conform. Really, the street conform is what makes it possible to build the curb, gutter, and sidewalk in the appropriate profile. So without it, we couldn't really, you can't have one without the other. I'm not sure, because we haven't considered it to this point, what we could build with 50,000. I mean, you know, it's a linear project essentially, so it's about a fourth of the length. It was a reasonable assumption, but you wouldn't be able to do a fourth of South 3rd Street because you'd be at a different profile and elevation than existing South 3rd Street, and you'd have a drop-off, and you'd have some kind of a change in grade between what's there now and what you're building. So mm-hmm. Maybe a portion along Rockaway could be constructed. But one other point to keep in mind, and I can't speak to the arrangement between the property owner
exactly.
and Verizon, but I could at least suspect that the property owner went into this agreement with the understanding that he was going to get these improvements along the entire frontage, and probably is what made it attractive to him to get into an agreement and a lease site with Verizon.
The resolution is, and I was going to bring that up, Mayor and Council members, the resolution approving, agreeing to the project is signed by the owner. One of the people who signed is the property owner. The other one is Verizon. So the benefits of this these improvements, if they are approved by the council, will flow with the property. And if there is future development on that property, that portion of it is going to be taken care of.
Okay. I mean, that does make a difference to me.
Yeah, it does.
But the issue, so then the issue of bond is really more a surety. I think this is not an uncommon practice what they're asking for, so I don't have a problem with that. But, you know, I understand what you're saying about the owner signing, and it's obviously we've had others do this before. They agree to conditions to get their approval, and then they obviously have the ability to come back and request a waiver, and we don't have to approve it. So I'm not sure if they got the improvements and then, or the conditions, and went back and said, let's put a dollar value on it and see if we can go forward with this project, because I think we just saw a major project with the landfill do that. They have an EIR, and it was in the paper this weekend, where they had an EIR that was going, and then they looked at it and see, in fact, what those conditions placed on that project was going to add from a cost standpoint, and they said, we're going to challenge EIR. So, you know, this is not something sinister from Verizon. I think it's just something we're going to have to look at in an objective manner, and let's do some due diligence here, because I don't know if that owner has plans, and I don't know what their agreement is, and yeah, you're right, they signed off on this, so but I'm just telling you from a fairness standpoint, I'm really having trouble getting there.
Yep. Mayor, if I might comment, you know,
yeah.
I think we've seen this come up on other potential projects where they have a dual frontage, or where the frontage improvements are pretty expensive compared to what's proposed. What's unusual about this one is that most applicants, like in the case of the EIR you mentioned, are looking at this before they get the project approved. You know, for example, the EIR, they go out, they get the EIR, they're looking at now what they're doing their due diligence to determine what's it going to take to develop the site. We've had that occur in a number of pre-application meetings on other sites just recently this year. So we're in the process of due diligence. The applicant said, and so what are the requirements? And we say, well, here's 9137.9. The code says you'd have to do this. And then they've said, well, boy, that'd be pretty expensive. Is there any way we could get that waived? That's a good time to talk about that and ask that. In this case, the applicant is coming after the project's been approved, after there's been a public hearing, after, you know, everybody's seen it.
Yeah, so but the council's the only one that can approve a waiver, correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
Can I make a...
Yeah.
How is this different than a homeowner who has a corner lot that has no curbs or sidewalks or anything, and they have to do that? I mean, we're talking, this is a commercial entity, right? But a homeowner has that same obligation, don't they normally?
Deny the waiver, but give them the opportunity to post a bond and complete the project within 4 months, which gives them the opportunity to get operating right away.
Is that correct? Is that correct? Okay. That's what I would recommend. That's my motion.
I second that.
Okay. If there's no additional discussion, let's do a roll call.
Yes.
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 I'm going to vote no. I think the bond is a good measure. I just think it sends the wrong message. I mean, I could go on all night and give you the differences between this and the other, but I'm not going to do that because I think we operate up here and we do what the majority would like. So the motion passes on a 3-1. Very good.
What?
Okay, Mr. Ray, I think we're moving on to item 13, and this is a status report on the short and long-term strategy for street rehabilitation.
Thank you, Honorable Mayor and City Council. In February 2011, a short-term street rehabilitation program was adopted by City Council. However, both council and staff are aware that a short-term and a long-term strategy are needed in order to sustain the city's entire network of streets at an acceptable level. Tonight's verbal report discusses street maintenance costs, potential methods for funding short- and long-term street rehabilitation needs. There's considerably more detail in the written staff report and a number of attachments I'll allude to. The city has approximately 9.6 million square feet of asphalt-paved streets. Existing pavement conditions range from severely deteriorated to new, and there's a rating index called a PCI that ranges from 0 to 100 that's used to rank rate the condition of streets, so with 100 being a brand new street, essentially. In 2010, we updated the assessment and concluded that approximately 85% of the city's streets had a PCI, a pavement condition index, below 60. And then also, probably more alarming, is that approximately 50% of the city's major connecting streets had a PCI below 60. Now, 60 itself is not in really bad condition, but it is critical to note that a PCI of 60 from a pavement condition our pavement management system technology is a point where the appropriate asphalt maintenance strategy changes from preventative maintenance to major removal and replacement. And in the long run, if you can maintain all of your pavements above a PCI of 60, the costs are significantly less. We did some estimates and determined that if the city were to begin a long-range maintenance program with the streets starting in good condition, a PCI above 60, the cost to maintain all of the major connecting streets, that's just the major connecting streets, which are reflective of your current short-term strategy, the 30-year cost would be about $18.5 million, which calculates out to about $617,000 a year. So if you started with all your major connecting streets in good condition, 30-year cost to maintain them, $617,000 per year. In order to achieve that starting condition, though, it would be clear that the city would have to identify a one-time large funding source to basically elevate the major connecting streets to that condition. A reasonable estimate of the cost to maintain all of the city's streets for 30 years is about $48 million, and breaking that down to per year be about $1.6 million per year. So pretty expensive. In recent years, we've made some pretty good progress. At council direction, the city has focused much of its effort and combined resources to either concentrate rehabilitation on major collectors and arterials or complete projects that had a special focus. Some examples would be the Safe Routes to School project, the Ramona Transit Hub phases 1 and 2. And so these were funded by a variety of grant funds. But also local funds were allocated to street rehabilitation. That includes the street rehabilitation funds from Project 283. That's the annual street rehabilitation project. redevelopment agency funding, water funds and sewer funds where water and sewer lines were a part of the project, and local transportation funds. Using those combined resources, grants, and the shared, and that was the major connecting streets list, which is attachment one in your staff report. And the adopted strategy, short-term strategy, continues to prioritize the repair of major connecting streets. This fiscal year, the city is scheduled to complete Brighton and North 13th. And it's a section of Brighton between, a section of Brighton between North 13th and Oak Park, and Nice Avenue between 12th Street and South 13th Street. And that's with remaining funds from Capital Improvement Project 283. In addition to completing Brighton and Nice, West Grand Avenue Phase 2 project will be completed this year between 8th and 11th, and preliminary engineering on the repair of Oak Park Boulevard will be completed. Funding for this current short-term street repair strategy is expected to remain limited. There's attachment 2 to your staff report shows the CIP funding for CIP 283. Next year, the CIP project continues to use approximately $200,000 in gas tax funds. And in fiscal year 15, the budget contemplates the return of the use of general funds. Staff will continue to maximize resources available for street repair. For instance, we are aware of an additional $90,000 in TDA funds that will be available as a result of the urban designation we just received. Some residual gas tax funds may also be available at year's end, and staff will obviously continue to seek out grant funding where appropriate. Still on the short-term strategy, staff is also aware of a number of intersections and small street sections that are in serious need of repairs. In addition to the recommendations above to continue the short-term strategy, staff is recommending identifying a very limited list of street areas that need immediate repair. If additional funds remain at the end of the fiscal year, either due to projects being completed under budget or unexpected street maintenance income, some or all of the streets on this short list could also be repaired. So now moving on to the long-term funding strategies. In order to plan for a sustainable street system, the city needs a long-term strategy that includes additional annual street maintenance funding, large one-time funding allocations, and strategies to reduce the cost and amount of pavement maintenance. Council previously considered long-term rehabilitation strategies, including seeking additional grant funding opportunities, seeking low-interest infrastructure loans, bond financing for system-wide improvements, and, again, to continue to implement strategies to reduce the amount of pavement maintained. There are a number of additional funding sources that could be considered as part of this multifaceted long-range approach, and these include street maintenance assessment districts and public and private partnerships. Current economic development strategies and economic recovery are expected to eventually result in increased general fund income. So in the future, this will provide additional funding that could be used directly on street maintenance or as a funding source for bonds and loans. Tonight, staff has identified a couple of alternatives for council to consider. First, council could confirm the current short-term and long-term strategy for street repair. Council could direct that changes be made to the short-term and long-term strategy for street repair, or council could provide additional direction to staff. Staff is recommending that council, by motion, confirm the existing short- and long-term strategy for street repair. And that concludes my report.
Great. Thank you, Greg. Okay, who's got questions? Yeah, Debbie.
On the page 4, you mentioned public-private partnerships could include offering city matching to private funds to implement street repairs. Can you give me an example of what you mean by that? I just not following.
For example, let's say a business along one of our major arterials or collector streets was interested in improving the pavement in front of the business, or property owner was. The city, and they were interested to the extent that they were willing to pay for quite a portion of it. The city could possibly offer a percentage matching to make it possible for that business or property owner to go ahead and complete those improvements.
Thank you. And I believe those were my only question. That was my only question.
Okay. Phyllis?
Yes. I don't see here, unless I'm missing something, you talked about some intersections that really needed to be worked. Yeah, definitely. So then using this list, can you tell me which ones are next? I know we have the other phase of West Grand Avenue. What else will we going to be doing then?
So, of course, not on the list are the sections of Nice and Brighton, which council has agreed to complete. And then Oak Park is the next one being looked at for design at this point.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Okay. Bill or Karen, any questions?
I have none.
Microphone.
Okay. I don't know if I have questions. I have comments, and I'm sure once we start having this conversation, questions will come up. This is a business item. Is anyone that's in the audience that would like to address this item before the council? Seeing none, let's bring it back. Okay, so Greg, you're basically asking saying what our options are that we can confirm the current short-term and long-term strategies for street repair, meaning doing nothing. You've given us an update on where we are, and the next list are on from the current short-term strategy is Brighton and Nice. And then we had a priority of major connecting streets, correct?
And basically, to continue to focus on major connecting streets, Nice and Brighton, with this upcoming CIP 283 funds, and then next year we'd be coming back to you with a recommendation for the next streets within that list of major connecting streets to be repaired.
So now I heard you say $18 million. Can you clarify what that $18 million would go for again? Is that something you were estimating that would cover these major connecting streets, or was I wishful thinking? Because I know we talked about $48 million to do all the streets.
Yeah, we looked at it two different ways. If we just look at the list of major connecting streets, a 30-year maintenance cost on that, assuming that we stayed in that upper PCI range, so that means every few years we would slurry seal, and then we would do minor, overlays and things like that to the street. It would be about $18.5 million over a 30-year life cycle on that list of streets alone. So it'd have to start in good condition, 60 or above, and we would just continue with a regular policy. So that's what that represents.
But we have to get them to that level first.
Right. The $48 million is all your streets, every street in town.
May I ask a question there?
Yes.
So, but that $18 million takes into consideration getting them to that.
Does not.
That doesn't get them to the 60% level?
No.
Mm-mm. Oh. Well, have to fire. Okay. Well, that's no good.
So $18 million over 30 years, you just divide it. That would be part of a regular program to maintain them, but you'd need a large one-time funding source to propel you into arena, if you
gotcha. And that's just for the major connecting streets.
That's correct. Street pavement maintenance is very expensive.
And how many streets would that be? Do you know?
I can't remember how many were on the list, but
you're not talking this list.
That list, yes.
Just that list?
That's correct.
Oh, my word.
Why do, just a comment about this. Why don't we, when we're doing this, why don't we mix in a residential street every now and then, just because I think residents would feel that there's been some kind of progress. Part of the concern has been we always seem to be working on the same streets. all the time. So I would think it might be a nice little bit of PR to stick a section of residential in every now and then maybe people might be willing to look at a little increase in sales tax or something if they see some progress.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. I guess from my view is you tell that to the people who live on Long Branch. Long Branch is more of a residential street than a commercial street. I mean, so that's always been the challenge in Grover is that you'd be hard-pressed to find a street that doesn't have a house on it. Now, that doesn't mean it's not residential. So I was thinking maybe the thought, and I'll throw a concept out there because clearly, I think I have this meeting and the next. So I'm just going to kind of put this out there. Because I'm thinking if we're talking about the current short-term strategy in which we've made a commitment to do Brighton and Nice, and so, again, how much money do we have to put toward those streets this year and maybe even the next fiscal year?
I believe the remaining funds are $259,000 in CIP 283, plus the additional.
We were going to be able to use it on the streets all the time.
Mr. Mayor, if I could,
yes.
You'll annually review it because that's what they call the project operating program. But you should have that same amount will reduce the amount of TDA contribution that we're annually making. So that should be an ongoing figure. It'll be annually reviewed by SCAT, but unless there is a policy change, I would see that would be reoccurring.
Okay.
Because then the other thought I had was, why wouldn't we take these major connecting streets? I think some are done. So 4th Street, for the most part, with the exception of maybe a small section between I drive and bike by there every day. So Seabright to, I think, Farrell. Seabright to Farrell.
Yep.
So that's pretty much done.
North 12th. Done.
Yeah, North 12.
Atlantic City's done.
So I'm just wondering if we put a cost to these with respect to what it would take to rehabilitate these beyond patching holes, but getting them to that index level, the PCI of 60, what's that cost? And I think maybe if we knew what that cost was, maybe that's something that could be looked at as far as whether it's a bond measure or some other way. That way we're not talking about $48 million. It's something that really talks about attacking the major connecting streets that allows people to circulate throughout the city and get destination places. And then you still would have, the third part of this would be ongoing gas tax and the general fund coming back and getting those levels back up to, let's say, $400,000 to $500,000. Then you can use that to continue to attack, or not attack, but continue to use that to put that money on neighborhood streets. So I'm just thinking maybe that's a three-prong approach that might be worthy of some discussion. I know we can't necessarily make decisions tonight, but I thought I would put that out there just as food for thought. I mean, because I think if, in fact, the incoming council chooses to pursue a bond measure or some other measure down the road, because I think that's really the only one that this public-private partnership and the street main assessment districts, I'm not convinced on those, but I think at some point you do need to start the process of going out and asking the community what they're willing to contribute. Because I think when we first started doing this, my goodness, maybe four or five years ago, we had identified possible ways, and then I think even the staunchest even the people who do come and say, fix my streets, do this now, and when we identified a possibility of, say, well, let's go out and ask the question about bonds, even they said that the streets are fine, don't do anything. So, maybe at some point you're going to have that discussion of if you're looking at a bond or some other way to have some funding for long term, you're going to have to start the process of getting someone to go out and doing an inventory and bringing someone on to do some polling to find out just where the community is and see what is in fact reality, or and then I think you can come up with a long-term solution. But short of that, I think we have to continue doing what we're doing, because we have made some progress.
Yeah, and we do have to maintain what we've done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So. Okay. Just another little comment.
Okay.
Okay. I notice we have a hope that the general fund will improve, mm-hmm. correct? Mm-hmm. My only thought is that then we need to keep a very strict look at our budget and not stray from a tight budget, so that we do have that extra money coming in for the streets. I think that's an important thing that we need to keep in mind.
That sounds like something you all are going to have to talk about.
I mean, you know how we just how we're so extravagant with our with our money.
Yeah, well, you know, I think the point being really is the general fund, the economy gets better, the general fund gets better. I think we have been, with the exception of maybe the last year and a half, we had been very diligent about putting at least $400,000 to $500,000 on the streets, and so we're hoping that we can return to those levels. So, yeah, I may be at the podium coming in here reminding everyone from time to time. No, I'm not going to do that.
Feel free.
I would never do that.
Oh, I don't know. You might need to.
Anyway, so this is just a status report, unless we want to give staff some different direction.
Right.
What's the pleasure of the council? And from the community.
Yeah, because mm-hmm. the list
2014.
The list is beneficial, but mm-hmm. it would be nice to know, well, finished or, you know, projected cost
yeah.
to do the next one.
Yeah.
And then we can make a choice then to pick, you know, mix and match.
Yeah, I'll leave that to you all.
Okay.
So there is a motion. There is a second. There is no resolution. So let's do this by voice vote. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? None. Motion carries. And so just a further clarification then, that we're going to move forward on Brighton and Nice with the funds we have available, correct? So if someone in the community asks, there's a council has committed to doing those streets, and we're going to move forward. Okay. Sounds like a plan.
Good.
Okay. So. Wow. And thank you, Greg.
Thank you.
We don't have any pool consent items. How about council committee reports? Anyone have anything they want to report tonight?
I have two.
Okay.
Quick, fast. On APCD, there's concern about the lack of progress with the state on their PM reduction program. So the board concluded that a letter would be sent to others in the state offices outlining the agreement and milestones that had been agreed upon so that everyone is aware of what is expected. There is a deadline, the next milestone, the deadline is due, or these milestones is due November 30th, so we're hoping that they'll come through and we'll be back on track again. So that's the HAPS there. And then Integrated Waste Management, the judge ruled in favor of the IWMA against the Save the Plastic Bag Coalition. Mm. So they must file an appeal by December 14th of this year. Also, it was ruled in favor for the county and city of San Francisco. An appeal has not been filed as of that day, that was Wednesday, by the Save the Plastic Bag Coalition. They are now in an appeal with Marin County at this point in time, because Marin County that was ruled in their favor against the Save the Plastic Bag Coalition. There has been a latex paint management program initiated in our county. There are 30 sites that collect paint here in this county, as opposed to like 6 in Fresno and less than that in Monterey and Santa Barbara County. So we are quite ahead of the game here. There's a 33% retrieval statewide and 94% in our county. So we are apparently moving along, ahead of the game. So that is the state of the IWMA.
Very good. Phyllis, you have anything?
Yes, I do. Actually, I attended both the RAC and Zone 3. I wasn't able to go to the Housing Trust. To keep it short, we will most likely, due to credit from county overhead, have brought about $74,000 credit going into next year for with the water. And then there are a couple of projects. There's a Prop 50 that Zone 3 is going to look into accomplishing, because there is a it's $1,024,700. There's a grant of $512,350, so we have to come up with matching funds. And because three of the current projects all came under the estimated costs, we will only need to acquire another $252,000. And since there are some of the projects that are going to be deferred, the money will come from there. And some issues with the RAC. The IRWM plan is proceeding very slowly. We did come up with the first portion of it, which is the MOU, which we still need to sign. And that has changed the governance structure so that we are actually, there's three sections of it. All of the signatories are all considered our WMG agencies, which is the Regional Water Management Group agencies. That includes Grover Beach, Arroyo Grande, Oceano, manager, in which we can give our input as to how the plan, the rest of the plan should be written. And that's basically it in a nutshell. It's become a little more complicated, actually.
They always do.
Oh, yes.
Debbie?
Mm-hmm. Mine aren't critical. I'll wait till next opportunity.
Okay. Bill?
The sanitation district meeting was held on the 7th. The plant superintendent's report was good. No significant problems. We had a presentation of the local hazard mitigation plan, which the board accepted the presentation, which is what we were supposed to do. We approved a number of purchases for the continued plant maintenance. And we authorized staff to go out for bids for the trunk cleaning system, cleaning the system, and video inspection of all of the trunk lines in Arroyo Grande and Oceano. Grover Beach was done 2 years ago, within the last 2 years. So we're now take care of Oceano and Arroyo Grande. And the last item on the agenda, the board directed staff to proceed with the filing of an appeal on the December 2010 spill. That's it.
Okay. So I only really have two things. Well, not even that. The SLOCOG board is meeting on December 7, 2012, and the official agenda has not come out yet, so I'm not up to speed on what, in fact, they'll be considering at that meeting. The other thing was there was, in fact, a SCAT board meeting. And one of the things that came out of that was the need to amend the joint powers agreement, which was on our consent calendar tonight. Thanks, staff, for doing that in such a short time frame. The major reason for doing this JPA amendment was with respect to the Regional Transit Authority. Everyone was appointing an alternate. The alternate could come and listen and give input, but they did not have the ability to vote, so they needed to clean up the agreement to allow for that to happen. So I believe that's been taken care of. We took a vote on it, and it will just be finalized at the next meeting, which will be December 7th. So that's all I have on that.
I think I'll wait and have Bob kind of give everyone an update on the Gilbert Beach Lodge and Conference Center, because I think there's been a couple of meetings and we've got some other items coming up very soon. So do you want to do that now, Bob?
Mr. Mayor, as the council is aware, staff did meet with Dr. Charles Lester, executive director from the Coastal Commission. He was by last Tuesday for a brief meeting, looked at the site, and we discussed the possibility of moving the project forward on an agenda in January. We don't have any confirmation from staff yet that will be done, but it is a good possibility since that meeting will be in Pismo Beach, and they indicated that they were open to it. So we're hoping that the final staff report will be wrapped up on their end and be ready to go by that time. Also, in relationship to that, I met on Thursday with the leaders of the equestrian group and discussed, brought them up to speed as to where the project is at. They are still supporting the JA's position to locate the staging facility south of Grand, and they're going to be willing to start communicating with the Coastal Commission to do that. Also, another meeting that is related and is important is actually the next meeting of the Coastal Commission that will be held in middle December in San Francisco. The reason that's important and we should have some attendance there is because they are going to have a workshop on the processing of local coastal plan amendments, and that's essentially what we need to get from the Coastal Commission is the plan amendment approved. And so they're going to have a workshop that will be participatory and between local jurisdictions that are members of the Coastal Cities Group and the Coastal Commission themselves. Not only is it important for us to attend for that reason, but it will also be a time for us to begin meeting individually with commissioners. And
commissioning went very well because we were able to talk to them about their process and the local coastal program and trying to figure out what are the issues, because not every city that's in the coastal zone has a local coastal program. And why is that? And then why is it that if you have an adopted local coastal program and a project comes forward that's consistent with it, that it still takes a long time to get through the process? So that'll be a great opportunity to go up and be part of that, and then also have private meetings, I think, with some of the commissioners. I know Allison Roth from Pacifica will be going. I think Bob's going, and I'm checking my calendar to see if I can join you all, because I think that it will be critical to start reaching out to commissioners in advance of the January meeting. And I think the only other thing I wanted to clarify is on January 2013, if we're successful in getting on the Coastal Commission agenda, there is a amendment to our local coastal program, and the two things that stick out in doing that, or maybe three. One is, as you all know, the proposed project looks at providing equestrian facilities on the south side of Grand, so we need to change the LCP to accommodate that. I'll just tell you that the Coastal Commission staff has expressed concerns about that because they've deemed it environmentally sensitive habitat area. I think state parks, the biologists have said that it is not, so to be continued. The other part of it is that there is, in the way that the local coastal program has been interpreted, originally the site for the hotel development down there was 22 acres. Now we're talking about 13 acres. And so there's a, depending on how you interpret it, areas where they've said certain percentages of this project can be three stories, a percentage can be two stories and then one story, and so there's a slight difference, and so we have to allow for that. And then finally, there are some public improvements, water lines and sewer lines that need to be discussed in the LCP. Right. So that all said, what would typically happen is if we're successful in getting the Coastal Commission to approve the LCP amendment, then the next step would be to come back to the council for a coastal development permit. Too many acronyms rolling around
up
here.
That's correct.
And I think we're investigating if we can do the two things at the same meeting in January, because, well, we worried about the, I mean, this has been a long time coming, and so how do we expedite the process? So,
one question.
Yeah.
How long prior to the meeting does the Coastal Commission generally come out with their agenda?
Well, about 2 to 3 weeks, is it, Martin?
Mm-hmm. Probably a couple of weeks.
Yeah. The staff report itself isn't made public until the week before the meeting, but we should get a pretty good indication whether they're going to make January about the middle of December.
And then their staff report probably won't come out until the new year.
Right.
Okay. So I did want to, Five Cities Fire Authority, I think the last meeting was canceled and I missed one prior to that, but two things that this council needs to be aware of is the employees for Five Cities Fire Authority are currently Aurora Grandy employees, because that was the most expedient thing to move this process forward. The board had given them direction a few months ago to look into the prospect of having the employees that are part of this authority become authority employees. And I don't know where we are in that process. I will try and find that information and get that back to you. The other thing is that, unless I haven't heard anything, that they are still moving towards benefit assessment district.
Yes.
And what does that look like and the timing of that? As we briefly, as I had mentioned, a bond or something on the streets, you'll want to definitely take a look at that. I mean, that doesn't have to be on a general election ballot, but certainly you want to be looking at the timing of that if they move forward. So I think that's worthy of mentioning to you all. Okay. And I promise that's really all I have tonight. Let's see. We don't have any city council member items tonight. Any council communications?
Well, I guess I do.
Okay.
I think. I'm not sure if I call this communications or not. But I'm wondering, since we're still not sure of our charter measure, I-12, is it possible to have a discussion about if we can get it on our next agenda to a discussion about the outcome?
A number of them today. The city clerk was in attendance observing the process. The last indication we had from the county clerk was that she was going to be able to certify by November 30th, which is the last Friday of the month.
Okay.
She has, though, by law until December 4th to certify. Our next meeting and the meeting to seat the council had been identified as December 3rd. There is a potential that her certification would not be done until the 4th. We would not be able, in that case, to seat the new council.
So then let's follow that train of thought through. So what are the implications of that?
Well, the immediate implication is you also will not be able to do the assignments. And I think that the option that staff discussed is whether or not you wish to move forward and receive basically move forward with the meeting and run the chance that the certification is not here at the time of the meeting, in which case the meeting would be very short, Or the second option is whether or not you want to consider canceling the meeting of the third, and rescheduling that for a few days later when the certification, as a special meeting, when the certification
is likely to be complete.
I feel like there's all these eyes looking at me.
I'm wondering if we were to go ahead with the meeting on Monday night and we don't have the information we need, how long would it take us to schedule another meeting from there? Do we need to notice it?
Yeah, you'd have to notice it.
Yeah, let's
just get some work done on the third.
No, I'm not just asking a question.
Yeah, you can do it in 24 hours.
One of the things that we had thought about is to have all the draft staff report, all the staff reports ready to go, and we would release those to you in agenda form per our regular timing. And what it would mean is that we would simply have blanks where the count number had to be filled in, and we just may have to wait until that Monday to do that. That's the option, if that's understandable, is we would just provide you the information we had and then fill out the blanks when we knew exactly what those answers are.
And you would be basically in an agenda packet, you would have a few resolutions that would have fill in the blank type of thing with the numbers, and also one resolution that shows that the measure I-12 passed and one resolution that shows it that it doesn't, and you would act on the one that would be appropriate, assuming we have a certification in our hands.
So that's the option.
You prepare for both options and assume that Friday night the clerk will receive a certification and we move forward with the meeting on Monday and you take action on the resolution that is appropriate based on what we know and so, based on the certification.
So where are we at with the December 17th? Was that one of the meetings we had talked about?
Yes.
Not holding?
Well, it's scheduled right now.
Oh, okay. Never mind.
So we could go ahead and meet on Monday night and then adjourn till Tuesday night, if need be, or...
Well, the problem is you could. The question is how many days... 24 hours.
Can't we just move it, do something on December 10th?
Yes, you could.
And eliminate all of this.
Why don't we do it on December 4th?
No, more like the 6th or 7th. I mean,
well, if she has to certify by the 4th.
Yeah, why don't we just do it the 4th?
Because what if she certifies at 5 o'clock at night?
We're meeting at 6.
Oh, on the 4th?
30. Right.
But we will still have the same agenda packet. You would have the same agenda packet mm-hmm. that you would have on Monday night.
Right.
You would still basically...
But we wouldn't have the numbers.
My suggestion, I actually support, if I can, the mayor's suggestion.
The outgoing mayor's suggestion.
Change it to the 10th.
That moving it
I'm
to
just
the
trying not to insert myself way too much. I mean, that means obviously... So you
moving it to the
do.
10th would actually be fairly simpler, I think, on staff. That would allow sufficient time to have the certification done. We can complete the reports, and then we know on December 10th.
You'll have a person who would still be serving in that role as an alternate. But that, obviously, you
in
guys...
In most cases, yeah.
Everything can, mm-hmm. yeah, in most cases.
An assignment on the 10th, which we don't have to identify the person that's going to go... to the training.
I thought you did.
Prior to the 11th.
Prior to the 11th.
Because they have to attend a meeting on the 11th. They would have to attend a meeting on the 11th from 2 to
3:30. Whoever was assigned on the 10th could attend on the 11th.
Mm-hmm. And I guess what I'm just saying is that Bill Nichols is the alternate to the Five Cities Fire Authority, and I think their original intent was to have a representative that was on that board go for the training, but that's... Yeah, some of you guys have to talk about.
Oh, no, that's not how I interpreted it.
Well, hey, I'm just saying it's 10:18, so you guys can decide this. So you're going to put it on December 3rd? You want to...
See, I plan to go.
As much as you can and have cake and wish me well, and I'll wish you all well, and we're good to go. I just don't want to be here till midnight tonight.
I'm happy to do it on the 3rd, and but I'm only one of five, so.
But can't we just do it later in the week, like Thursday or something?
Are there any conflicts with Thursday?
That way you'd still have your time and.
I have no
Thursday
idea. I don't have my schedule.
Is December 6th.
I mean, it's.
I don't know.
I think we should just take our chances with Monday.
I agree. We can decide on Monday. We can bring our calendars and we can figure it out. I don't have mine tonight, so I can't respond.
I have faith in the county clerk recorder.
That's the consensus. That's what we'll do.
I don't care. Sorry.
I'm trying
to make it easy. I don't know what the rush is. So
yeah,
you know,
I don't
you
agree
get,
with this
If you
want
to just get it certified and eliminate the guesswork, you know, that would be my suggestion. But I don't have a strong feeling one way or the other.
And
so you guys decide.
I agree with you.
I can't make a decision on Thursday because I don't have my calendar.
And I can't either.
So if you guys want to do that, that's fine.
Unfortunately.
I don't care.
December 3rd.
December 3rd.
Okay.
And I did want to follow up on Karen's suggestion that it would be very helpful, I think, on that night if we're going to be reporting election results or almost election results. I think it would be helpful to have a report on Measure I so that we know people know where it is. Rather than just leaving it open?
Well, what do we need to talk about? We already know what it is.
Did it win or did it lose?
When it's certified, then we'll know.
You're certified, you'll have the results. It'll be part of that packet anyway. And you'll know. Right now, the official is that it's 4 votes down.
Right. Okay, so that will be final on the night.
With 13 to count?
No. No more to count.
No.
They're just checking it.
Okay.
That's all it is.
So I would like to agendize.
So they're doing
it.
They're doing a recount. Okay.
Yes.
I'd like to agendize at some point that we talk about the measure and the election, and maybe not on the 3rd, but I thought it might be a good time just because let's get it all done on the 3rd and move on.
Provided you have the election results.
Yeah. If we don't, then we have to move on when we have
them. If you don't have the election results, you can't seat the new council.
No, there's not going to be. There
so
won't be a meeting, basically. Other than
there won't be a meeting.
Opening the meeting and
closing
and deciding on when to continue it to.
Which I think is a waste of time. Let's just pick another date after we get the results. I mean, it doesn't make sense.
I don't have a calendar, so I can't come.
Oh, we cannot survive without our calendars?
No,
come on, don't you know
cannot.
What you're doing on a Thursday?
So, okay, hold on. So can you just, the 3rd is a regular meeting.
Right.
And if we don't have election results, is there a way, I guess officially you'd still have to come down and just continue the meeting.
It's noticed.
It's going to be noticed. So.
I have a question about that. If we know that there's going to be no reason to hold a meeting, can you just have a meeting? The council doesn't have to be present, do they? Quorum doesn't have to be present, do they?
There's no quorum
present, there's no meeting.
You know what? May I make a suggestion? How about if we go to the Monday then? Because Mondays, we know
Monday. The 10th?
I mean, I know Mondays. I always keep Mondays open because I never know when we're going to have a special council meeting. Are we open on Mondays?
We have to go to San Francisco on Tuesday, or not all of
oh,
us.
Oh, there was a concern about that next, the 11th, though.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a concern? A real concern? That. Somebody would not be able to make. I don't know about the Thursday. I don't have my calendar, and yes, I need my calendar. So that's my answer to that. So I'm good on a Monday. Are you guys good on a Monday?
I don't know, but I would assume I would be. I don't remember every day of my week. Unfortunately, they're a little bit
I don't
busy.
Either. I do know Monday, though.
So. I don't even remember 7 a.m. this morning.
I know Monday. That's all I know.
Bill?
Okay.
What do you think, the 10th?
Whenever you hold it, I'll be there. Don't worry.
That's my line.
Okay,
don't
let's have a
line.
Hand vote. This
well,
is
hold on. So I think we're there. So Debbie?
I'd still prefer the third, but if I'm outvoted, I'm outvoted.
Okay, so.
10th.
Do the 10th, and I guess if you learn something before then, that's good.
Well, yeah. What do you mean if you learn something before?
No, never mind.
Change it to the third.
What did the attorney say? I withdraw the question or that I withdraw the statement.
Okay.
All right. Okay. So, you have one thing for communication?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I wonder what the rest of you think. We're getting a little bit behind the times, still putting out all this paperwork. I know that Rio Grande City Council has gone to iPads. I know that the city of San Luis Obispo has gone to iPads, and I wonder if we should not ask staff to look into the cost of providing council members with iPads and eliminating this tremendous volume of paperwork that we put out every meeting. Do you think anybody else believe that it's worthwhile doing?
Well, the problem for me is I like to sit in the bathtub with it, and I don't think I should be dropping my iPad in the bathtub.
I don't think it's a bad idea, but I don't have an iPad, so it would have to be provided for me.
Well, that's what the city would do.
Well,
that's the proposal, that they look
about
into
$400 each.
Look into the cost of providing iPads for each of the council members, and that we go to that system. Royal Grande did the same thing. And they looked into it and found it to be economical. They provided each of the council members with an iPad. My suggestion is that we ask staff to look into the possibility of our doing the same thing if, in fact, it comes out to be reasonable and beneficial insofar as cost and procedures are concerned. My thought is I would like staff to look into it and report back to us on that.
Okay, so...
Well, is the city going to be willing to pay for glasses for me? Because I start using that kind of stuff, and I will need glasses. At this age, I still don't wear glasses, and those things will ruin your eyes.
So why don't we do this? Let's see if there's a consensus to put this on an agenda, and you guys can have that conversation, that discussion. I mean, it may have some merit with all the reams of paper. I don't know what the cost is over a year. But, you know, maybe it makes financial sense and, yeah, you guys.
I'd say I'd be willing to put it on an agenda. I have my own. Right now I prefer to look at a paper copy, but I think it'd be up to each individual to decide if they would like to have it in electronic format or if they prefer to have it in paper format.
Because I imagine you would have an iPad and then you would have the ability to go on to the city's website and print out materials if need be, correct?
Right. You could do it either way. So. And there are many, many boards and commissions that are doing it that way. Mm-hmm. So I know the IWMA, they're trying to do that as well. Mm-hmm. But I prefer mine in a paper format at this point in time. But
so if you guys want, just put it on the agenda and have that conversation, that discussion,
yeah,
good
let's
information.
Let's agendize it.
Okay. I think everyone's starting to get a little punch drunk. So.
Yeah.
We went through committee reports. It was council communications. City manager.
Yes, Mr. Mayor, I've distributed to the council some options regarding signage. What I'm going to do is ask that you take a look at them and then provide me with your comments.
Not just now. But
not just
okay.
Now.
So I have to ask, I mean, is this what... GTA put together after all this time?
This is the initial designs I've seen.
They're all the same.
Different colorways.
So do you have an actual status report on the City Hall improvements?
The status report is, as I've indicated, we should be ready to go with a final recommendation to the council for the next meeting, December 17th. Which time we will have the final exteriors, the landscaping, and the parking lot. Parking lot is the main feature of that, plus recommendations regarding funding.
Okay. Well, my suggestion to you all is I'm not even sure why they did gave us this stuff.
The network, and we still are trying to schedule a follow-up discussion to that. He's had some personal issues this last couple of weeks, and that's why the delay.
Okay. And anything new on the train station expansion project?
Hopefully, by the end of the year, we should have the engineer available doing the construction drawings.
Okay, very good. Okay, so I think at this hour, it's 10:31, and we have no closed session, and we don't need a special vote to go past 11 tonight. So with that, we're going to adjourn this meeting.
Nice.